Hello and welcome to episode 169 of The Crate and Crowbar. It is the 7th of December, 2016. My name is Chris Thurston and tonight I'm joined by Tom Francis.
Hello.
Hi, Tom. It's just us this wintry evening and I'm drinking custard, as far as I can tell.
I have finished my custard and I've moved on to just the rum.
Delicious eggnog, which, so if you hear me sort of sound like I'm about to choke to death, that's because I'm still eating custard. Mid-pod.
Eggnog has nutmeg in it, and so I think they should call it eggmeg.
Eggmeg.
Mm.
Yeah, this isn't something that will help your voice if you have to, for example, speak for several hours. It is delicious, however. Luckily, I also have a glass of rum to make this truly a festive occasion. We should probably say, actually, that next week's episode is going to be our final episode for this calendar year. We're going to do another Christmas episode like we did last year. And then after that, we will be back in early January. And really, I could have imparted this information next week.
Yeah, it's good to have some warning, though. Like, ready for the end when it comes.
It's what I would want. So, yes.
We're going to have some special whiskey, don't we?
We are going to have a very special bourbon sent to us by a listener, which just arrived. But we figured we would save it for when we can present it to you in a visual format, because we're going to do what we did last year and tape next week's episode.
Visual is, for like appreciating whiskey, I'd say visual is one up on audio, but definitely still one down on tasting.
Yeah. Yeah, there's like
second best sense for a drink.
There is, you know, a basic appeal to looking at a nice bottle of whiskey, and, you know, it's one of the reasons I used to collect bottles, that's fine. But yeah, listening. Well, I don't know. We've been doing this for like almost 170 episodes. Like, clearly listening to whiskey is...
it's like, a popular...
There's some appeal there, or else this would never have worked.
People do like it when you, like, they hear the cork and pouring and stuff.
Mm.
It is quite nice.
Yeah, it's just, we don't really cork anything.
No.
On the podcast anymore. There's a lot of screw top bottles of rum.
Mm.
This is all stuff for the AGM, Tom.
AGM?
The annual general meeting. We don't have one. Do people even... I don't know if they do. So, speaking of AGMs in a really incredibly roundabout way, the AGM of the Jeff Keighley Society met last Friday to display a lot of adverts and give out prizes. And among those adverts for computer games, there were two that really stood out, I think? Question mark?
I heard some people sort of... not maybe complaining, but sort of like saying that, oh, it's a shame this award ceremony has to be, like, in order for it to make sense to do an award ceremony this size, you have to have it supported by these ads, like, and to have advertising on it. But to me, award shows themselves, although I'm glad they exist and I think they're a good thing, are incredibly boring to watch.
Yeah.
I get no enjoyment from just watching, like, a list of nominees and then someone being announced as a winner. Whereas new footage of games I'm excited about is really cool. Like, this is one case where ads are really good.
Yeah, because, I mean, I don't really have a horse in a game awards race, but, you know, I imagine those people really seriously do, because people get really, you know, upset if their chosen cause doesn't triumph.
I don't really understand that.
No. But, you know, you certainly see it, the golden joysticks, people get invested in the winners.
Yeah, well, you vote for that, so I guess, like, the...
They don't know that. They'd get extremely angry when the results come through.
Actually, is the Game Awards voted for?
No, it's judged.
Is it just Jeff Keighley who sits there and decides?
No, I think there's an international panel. I think it's a little bit like the IGF or something, or like the Game BAFTAs, I think, where there's like an invited jury. But
I think BAFTAs is like somewhere between a sort of more traditional judge panel and the IGF, where there's a huge pool. I don't know how many there are, but I should know how many there are because I emailed them all. Like when you're sending it, you have to send your game to all the judges, basically, and they just give you like a list of them, and it comes with all these like disclaimers like, do not email these people about anything else. Do not spam them about shit.
As a developer, what was your favorite awards process? Because you've been in contention for a BAFTA, a golden joystick.
I didn't ask Chris to do this segment.
Presumably also IGF, right?
Gunpoint was finest.
Which one of them was the most useful to you?
Because
I'm going to guess it wasn't the golden joystick.
I don't know that any of them are really useful. Well, I guess, no, IGF was, because if you're a finalist, you go to GDC and you show your game at a stand in the expo place and just show it to the public for several days, which is always great for testing. You just get loads of really good feedback. But also IGF's the only one I really care about. Or like, it's the only one where I assign some meaning to who wins and who doesn't. Like, pretty much every year at the IGF, I think, yeah, it's a good bunch of games. That's like, if there's stuff in there that I haven't heard of that wins, I usually play it and I usually like it.
Mm.
And whereas other stuff like, BAFTA is incredibly prestigious, but it's like most awards ceremonies, has an element of randomness to it, it seems. I think GTA 5 was up for most innovative game. And that's the kind of thing where you think, maybe this doesn't mean anything really.
Yeah. I mean, BAFTA is presumably extremely useful if you ever need to impress an elderly relative, right?
Mm.
Like, and that's great, that's not meaningless in this business, right? Whatever side of the fence you're on, anything you can take back to a grandparent and say, look.
My mom knows what it is.
Yeah. But at Jeff Keighley's Advertapalooza, there were lots of trailers for things like Hideo Kojima's Death Stranding. That didn't make any sense.
Nope.
That was just goo, a baby in a jar.
It's funny because I used to be completely disinterested in all things Kojima, because all I knew about them was that I played like a demo of Metal Gear Solid 1 and quite liked it, but everything else I knew was just like, oh, there's a 90-minute cutscene in this game, and it's all like... thing everyone says about him is he's a frustrated director and really wants to make movies, and that the game side of things is not that interesting. And then, they didn't say that, but that was my assumption from the fact that sounded like he's really into movies. And then, of course, Metal Gear Solid 5 completely changed my mind on that. And like, all the bad things they said about the cutscenes and stuff was all true, but then it's clear that, like, it's an incredibly it's incredibly like rich and deep and awesome game as well, and clearly not made by someone who's disinterested in in games. So now, like Death Stranding, I'm interested to find out what it is. But also, it's very clear this stage of the promotion for it is just the movie making stage. Like, it's just, I have no idea what the game is.
It's not even that. It's not, because you don't even tell what the movie would be about from any of the promotional material.
It would be a good movie, though, I think. Like, if the trailers we'd seen were the opening minutes of a movie, I'd be like, wow.
I really want to see what happens next. Mads Mikkelsen with loads of mascara on, controlling skeleton soldiers with his belly cables.
That part actually does start to feel like something from a video game, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's like, oh, like a commando with a bunch of units that he controls by some cables.
Yeah.
Although the cables don't seem to be necessary. Maybe they're like charging cables. The units have to come back and plug themselves in.
Skeleton charging cables. Yeah. There's a certain... They have to dock with Mads Mikkelsen again at the end of every mission. Or do you think he finds new skeletons and plugs them in and charges them up?
Yeah, Mads Mikkelsen has a larger power cable going out of his back to like the mains, and he's just the cradle for your skeleton soldiers.
USB hub Mikkelsen. So that was, yeah, he's the only developer in the world who begins the process of revealing his latest idea for a game by saying absolutely nothing and showing only uninterpretable like images and signs. Like, it is like first principles. It's not like, and possibly the opposite of how you would explain a game to somebody. It's not even start with lore. It's like start with a sort of highly abstract representation of what the lore might be and then get people to what the game actually is several years later.
I don't know if he feels this way, but it behaves like someone who either doesn't care about the sort of exact level of success that this game has, or is so assured of it, he thinks it probably won't have, doesn't need to like give it the hard sell really. He's just he knows whatever he does, like a whole bunch of people are going to watch with rapt attention, so he can take his time and he can show cryptic stuff, which would be a nice position to be in.
His Twitter is extremely good value for your follow, simply because, well, like if you tried to derive Kojima's personality purely from his work, you would maybe get the sense of a frustrated film director or something, or maybe you know, the sort of auteur game creative director who has like these big ideas and big visions for the kind of philosophical subjects he wants to tackle, even if it's sometimes a bit weird or ham-fisted. But Twitter is just a man who loves everything he encounters on his globe-trotting life of meeting celebrities, often unexpected celebrities. Like, here I am with Midge Ure. And I love these sausages. And I loved this, this romantic comedy on the plane. Brilliant. There's really no clear, like, set of tastes necessarily, apart from sausages.
Mm.
But aside from Death Stranding, But related to the subject of weird black goo and like, you know, dystopian futures where not all is as they seem is Prey, which like Arkane's reboot of the Prey sequel, which is now a reboot of Prey in its entirety.
The first trailer for that was quite sort of movie-like, wasn't it? It was about a guy sort of living the same day again and again, and his weird disease in his eye getting worse, and him having this sort of like dream about something dark in the stars.
He looks a lot like Graham.
Yeah, exactly like Graham. And there's a Lady Graham as well, right?
Yeah. She Graham.
Optional Lady Graham. But yeah, this was actual someone actually playing the game for, was it 8 minutes or something? Like a decent chunk of playing it. And I was mostly really enthused by it. I thought it has loads in common with System Shock, System Shock 2 specifically.
Did you see that one of the like the upgrade stations or something you can find is called a Looking Glass Terminal?
No. Funny enough, like I think there's a tip about that on the loading screen, and the loading screen itself is so much like System Shock 2's loading screen. It's the same circle in the same place. And
we should call it Smithstom Shock.
Did Harvey Smith actually work on it?
No, Graham Smith.
Oh, I see. The other Smith.
That's not a very good joke. Oh, well.
Smith is a common surname, dude.
It is, yeah.
But yeah, it... you know, there are upgrade stations where you spend points to unlock skills and stuff, as in System Shock. There are lots of things in it that feel really like systemic and immersive simmy, i.e. has a lot in common with Deus Ex and System Shock. But then none more so than when they show off the, like, I can't remember what their name for it is, but basically the strong arms org level 3, where you can pick up really heavy boxes and throw them. And it's like, that is in every Deus Ex game. It's such an immersive sim thing to do, because then you can, you know, stack boxes, you can, I'm sure there's going to be vents to climb into. And actually, as a someone who always gets that org in every game that I can, I was really impressed with how violently effective it was. Like, it was not just, oh, you can theoretically throw something the size of a vending machine a little bit and it will somewhat hurt someone if it bumps them into. You really fucking fling this huge crate, like, with enormous force, and everything goes
20 years of immersive sims has made you a connoisseur of throwing fridges at people.
Just the fact that there's a level 3 of it makes me really excited, because then it's like I can get really serious about my arms being very strong.
Yeah, I wonder what, you know, I can conceive of, because the Deus Ex thing is, right, it's like from a box you could carry normally to a really big box that you couldn't. But what's level 3 of that? Is it a car?
So the way it usually ends up being, like, with the strength organ, like, you know, Mankind Divided and Human Revolution, and Deus Ex 1, I think, you can just about pick up a really big thing enough to that you can move it out of the way. Whereas in Prey with level 3, it seems like you can pick up something of that size and absolutely fling it as if it was like a snooker ball.
And that was probably the least nuts power.
Yeah. So turning into a mug we already knew about, but that was great to see in action.
Yeah, I love the... So I like the way... I love the notion of enemies that pretend to be scenery objects.
I'm a little bit worried about that. Like, I like the idea, but then in practice playing it might be just really frustrating.
There was that thing,
I gotta shoot every bin.
Yeah, the gameplay demo of him, you know, whacking every, like, every dynamic physics object with a wrench. Good wrench, though, as you pointed out. I do like that idea, and I like, because there's something really stupid about the fact that you have such a command over, like, a psychic command over matter, to the extent that you can bodily mimic a mug and then roll around, which is a strange thing to conceive of doing. But if you can do that, why couldn't you just make yourself really small? You know?
I mean, a mug is quite small.
No, but, like, if you want to be small, why do you have to be a mug?
Oh, I see.
You know what I mean?
Oh, you could just be yourself, but tiny.
But tiny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's called mimic, isn't it? So maybe it needs, like, a... Like, you don't have a lot of conscious control over it, maybe. You just sort of have to, like, point to the power at something, and it has to copy its physical...
I would make an action figure of myself.
Just, like, craft one out of plasticine.
Yeah, exactly.
Mimic.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes. It's also, like, if you are... I guess it's also telekinesis, right? Because once you're a mug, you don't have any motor functions. So the fact that you can move around is...
Yeah, I was trying to figure that out. Like, yeah, it must be telekinesis, because, like, what else could it be? Because there are no muscles to flex.
Maybe you have a million tiny invisible legs that are, like, floating around. But he also turns himself into a grenade, and then rolls around to get past enemies, and then uses a kinetic blast power on the ground so that the splash damage, like, knocks him into the air, and then he can knock himself up onto, like, a ledge and then turn back into human form back up there, which is very cool. I don't know. It does it perfectly in the video, and it seems like one of those things where, like, in theory you can do this, but in practice you might never do it because that power costs a certain amount of mana, probably, and your chances of actually landing somewhere you want to go is maybe low. I also didn't know if that... It seemed strange to me that sort of doing a splash damage power to yourself usually hurts a lot, and it didn't seem to hurt him at all. And I wonder if that's, like, when you're in mimic form, you're... I don't know, like, if it wouldn't hurt a grenade, and you are a grenade, then...
I mean, that makes sense, fine. Right?
Yeah. But they obviously can't let you be invincible. Unless, I suppose that maybe it's just time limited, so you can't stay in that form for a certain amount of time.
Hmm. Yeah, it looks great, though.
Glue gun, where you can...
Oh, yeah.
Like, spray glue on walls, and then, like, basically draw a staircase on a wall, and then because it's sticking out from the wall, you can climb up it.
Or, like, glue enemies so they can't transform, and then you can smash them with a hammer. Yeah, look great. I think... The only downside for me was that it looks very familiar, that it looks so much like System Shock, and the space station is a little bit more sort of Baroque in some ways, but that makes it look like Bioshock.
Yeah. It's more colourful than System Shock, and maybe like a bit brighter than Bioshock, but yeah, it's very, very familiar. But I think I like that. The main thing I was concerned about was the shadowy nature of the enemies. Like, I'm not that excited about actually shooting them, and I want them to tell me, you can stealth this whole game, and if they say that, then I'm fine, because I don't have to fight them if I don't want to. But the sections where it was just like firing a shotgun at basically a cloud seemed really unfulfilling to me.
It's a nice, like, I appreciate the attempt to do something new with the concept of, like, an alien invasion, that it's not tentacle monsters again or whatever. Yeah. But yeah, like, it does seem like there's only so many things you can really do inside a game to create enemies. And
there's also, like, a really big kind of boss encounter that I don't know if scripted is the right word, but it felt like it was certainly that demo seemed very staged to have certain moments where now the monster smashes up this thing. And
well, it's actually a law that you're not allowed to end a gameplay demo without something hitting the camera. Like, yeah, the giant claw of a shadow beast or whatever. Something's going to hit the camera, because then you can't switch. Otherwise, you can't switch it off. The demo has to go forever. That's just the way it is. I like that the space station is called Talos 1. Literally named for the concept of hubris.
Should be fine, though.
Like, what were we thinking?
I think it's going to work out.
Yeah. Should have been called Good Idea 2. The other spaceship adventure that was demonstrated substantially for the first time was Mass Effect Andromeda.
Yeah.
And it was really interesting watching that become an actual game. And now that I've seen that, like, 2-minute gameplay trailer, I now feel like I can map out that entire experience.
it seemed pretty similar to the old Mass Effect in a way that is not surprising, but I think until they showed that, there was always something back in my mind of, like, maybe it'll be really different in some way.
See, I don't know if I necessarily agree that it looks a lot like Mass Effect. It looks a lot like my Mass Effect 1, but it looked a lot not like Mass Effect 2,
right?
And it looked a lot like Dragon Age Inquisition, which is not surprising, because I know they invested in that tech and the open world stuff and the Frostbite engine. But there was something about the combat, which was all outside, and I'm not saying the game will all be this, but like, when they shifted over to Dragon Age Inquisition, they created a combat system that could work in a sort of open world environment where you don't necessarily have a plan. In the Dragon Age context, it would be you don't necessarily have a pre-designed dungeon environment that these enemies will respond to in a sort of traditional Baldur's Gate-y way. And in the Mass Effect context, that's... You don't have some corridors and some waist-high cover and some sort of, like, pre-planned AI entrance points in order to create a kind of staged firefight, which is the way the game moved more and more towards Mass Effect 3.
I remember in, like, was it a prison or something in Mass Effect 2 where there's all these, like, low-cover panels that pop out of the ground when the fight starts. But, yeah, you're right. There was a lot of outdoor stuff. There's a Mako, but not called the Mako.
Called the Nomad.
Yeah.
Which is a shame, because they were always named after sharks before, and as far as I know, there's no... Because it was the Mako and the Hammerhead.
Right.
Which are both sharks. So, I don't know.
What was the Hammerhead in?
The Hammerhead was Mass Effect 2.
Yeah.
In the Firewalker...
Were there driving bits in that?
Yep. In the Firewalker DLC.
Ah.
Which was pre-order DLC. And it reappeared in the Overlord expansion, which was all right. You had a hover tank, basically, and then you have neither of those things in Mass Effect 3. But yeah, like, I was just struck by the sort of scanning minerals to collect them, and the that sort of open worldy feel of the combat, where you have like a lot of AI kind of running around dynamically and lots of different vertical elevation in this watchtowers and containers and stuff like that. But it felt much more like a RPG with powers than a shooter necessarily.
Mm.
Like less sort of aiming down, not aiming down sights, because it's obviously a third person shooter, but less of that, more sort of, you know, doing consistent damage with your gun while also triggering special abilities, which brings it much closer to Inquisition than I expected. And I liked Inquisition, but it was interesting to see Mass Effect go back so hard towards what the first game kind of was, which was like this sort of open world adventure that occasionally went inside.
Yeah. I hope that the shooting is still quite shooty. I like that in Mass Effect 3 and 2. You know, that's the thing that those games have over Mass Effect 1, is the shooting just feels way better.
Yeah.
And more actiony.
Yeah, and besides that, like, he didn't give too much away. The very familiar kind of encounter with a crime lord where you say, I need this thing, and they recline in a cool way and then say no, and then you punch pointed. Their friend or something. Yeah.
I really liked Mass Effect 1, I think. A bit where you dock at some planet and it's the usual thing, they tell you to put your weapon away and then you have the option of basically complying or not. I found it like genuinely really tense. I kind of knew I wasn't just going to be killed right here and now, but I sort of felt instinctively, I don't think I would put my weapon away. I think I need to keep my weapon out. And they get really insistent, and it was actually like it did successfully emulate the movie moment of like, well, actually, the tension that movies go for and actually don't really achieve, because you know what's going to happen in a movie. And in this, I kind of like, I'm actually not totally sure what will happen if I completely refuse to do this.
Mm. Yeah. So, I mean, I have faith that they'll do a good job, because like Inquisition had really great moments in it. But I think it tempered my expectations somewhat. Like it certainly didn't look as sort of like, I think because it looked like a departure for the series, but within very familiar confines from the same developer. For me, it was like, oh, yeah. Okay, this is what they have been working on. They have been, you know, there was a sense where around the launch of Inquisition that EA were really looking for their Skyrim. Like, that's kind of what they wanted. That was the push to make that an open world game. And I wonder if that's the sort of the direction overall for BioWare at the moment. It's not just BR, you know, fan-pleasing story RPG studio, but be our creator of open world games with loads of stuff to do, hung off a critical thread of missions, which was where Inquisition ended up.
Mm.
And I suspect that might be the destiny of the next generation of Mass Effect games, which is either fine or literally the worst thing that has ever happened, and possibly a proof that that games were a mistake in the first place, depending on who you ask.
Cool.
Yep. I thought it looked nice, and I like that the new Mindy is a little bit smaller than the old one, so that it can land on planets and you can hang out. And that was cool. I liked that. A lot of opinions on that spaceship. But that's boring for another time. What have you been playing, Tom? Have you been dipping into IGF stuff?
Yes. The IGF judging is now over. So in the last batch of things I played were Diaries of a Spaceport Janitor, which actually I didn't get through the IGF because they ran out of code, so I just went out and bought it. And that's a thing. I actually hadn't played it because I thought it was still in early access, but it's not. It's a sort of, I'm not sure how to describe the perspective, like somewhere between top down and over the shoulder game, where you are a janitor at a spaceport, but you are like a sprite in a 3D world, and it's a very pixelated and kind of crude 3D world. When you start up, the sort of Unity graphics options dialog box has only two options, bad and worse for graphics. And it's a really weird game in almost every way. Like, your job is to pick up trash and burn it for money. I think maybe the thing that you incinerate trash with sort of logs how much trash you incinerated, but then you like next day you pray at a shrine and you get more money for what you incinerated. I think you pray. So the thing you interact with is somewhere between a games console, a bank, and an altar. And it seems, so first of all, it seems like a game about picking up trash, and you just walk up to a little bit like smudges on the ground and you interact with them, and then you select incinerate, and that's you doing a job, and you get a little bit of money for it eventually. At some point, you just, the place is like quite big. a spaceport. It's sort of like the area surrounding a spaceport, really. It's open air. And it's just full of vendors, just loads and loads of, it's like a huge market. It's just shops everywhere. And they all sell something different, and they'll all only buy the same kind of things they sell. And there's so many different kinds of items in the game that I've played for sort of like 3 in-game days and spent most of my time walking around talking to vendors. And I only once found someone who could buy any of the things that I had. One of them was selling eyes, and he said, oh, you need eyes to get into a dungeon. And I bought an eye, and I ate it, and they did take me into a dungeon. And then it really, like, and that's when the credits roll, like, not like the end credits, but like the sort of intro titles happen in that dungeon in a really, like, cool way. And I was like, oh, so that actually is really a dungeon crawling game. And that was their kind of like coy, misleading intro. And then you get to the end of the dungeon and just, you just kind of get booted back out of it again. You're back at the spaceport and you're kind of like cursed. And the rest of the game is like figuring out how to get rid of the curse, I think. But I don't know. I know that I have to get 3 things, but the substance of going after those things, like one of them's in this temple of some kind, but I can't figure out a way into the temple. But still the vast majority of it is walking around picking up trash and incinerating it for money, because everything is locked off by money and you just have none. And you have to keep, you have to eat every day in order to be able to go to bed. And that costs a certain amount of money. And so I'm only just kind of keeping my head above water, going just making ends meet. And so my chances of ever buying like the interesting items that will get me, I'm assuming I have to buy some special thing to get closer to these quests. But I spend so much time just trying to make enough money to survive that I don't really get any further to those things.
Yeah.
And so like it feels to me like the game... for me, the game is just a kind of like open world pick up trash game. and it's really charming. Like it's just the world is so nuts and like most of the people you encounter are, there are so many different kinds of weird aliens that you encounter that, that it feels like everyone is different. Like everyone is a different species. And that's really impressive and cool. And some of them even feel like they're in different art styles to other ones. Actually, your 2 requirements are food, and the other one is gender, and you have to change gender on a regular basis. And so I went to I didn't know I had to do this. So I thought I was doing it for fun. And I went to a gender vending machine,
vendor.
Yes. And all of the things I could buy were like, it turns out these are not even genders, but they're methods of changing gender. And the one I got said, oh, this one lets you, harvest gender from the sun's rays. I'm like, okay, I love that. I can afford that, surprisingly.
Not going to lie, Tom. I've been confused for a couple of minutes.
And then after buying that, I was told that I had become hell gender and I feel amazing.
Okay, great.
And so the gender system appears to just be a sort of like another plate spinning need thing that you just have to interact with occasionally. If you don't, the game's font becomes corrupted, so you can't read anything because you haven't changed gender in too long.
That's amazing.
So it feels like there's one of those games with like loads of secrets to it because, you know, everyone's amongst the trash I'm finding, I'm occasionally finding like, oh, this is a kind of like, token that, adds this spell effect to, items in this wizard crafting system.
And
I have no access to any kind of wizard crafting system. So I don't know if that's a joke or if that actually is in there. And it's the game feels like it probably does have that whole system in there somewhere and it's just locked off behind buying something. And there are like multiple different things like that, you know, I'll keep finding bits of technology that seem to be part of some kind of tech system that I also am not involved in, which is kind of like, is how you would feel as a spaceport janitor, picking up weird bits of trash that sort of relate to other people's much more interesting lives that you can't afford to live. But I don't know if it's a game where you then do go out and live those lives or whether you really are just a spaceport janitor. And also at the end of every day, you write a diary about what happened that day. And since what happens tends to be colourful in nature, that works really well. Like my diary just reads, it just sounds completely insane, as you can probably guess from my account of it.
Yeah, like I follow, but I have no idea how someone started conceiving of this game.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know either. I still haven't really figured out whether it's a kind of carefully constructed thing that, you know, there's a master plan and you'll discover it eventually. And it just seems random when you're not when you haven't kind of got your teeth into it yet, or whether it's actually just all random madness and is kind of deceiving you into thinking there's a master plan. But either way, I like it. I'm probably going to play more at some point. I guess it has a little bit... It is funny. It has a bunch of like good item descriptions and stuff, and it has the feel of something that just has a huge amount of creativity and imagination in it. But I also got a strange like vibe from it that it felt a little bit hostile, not just because the life you're living is kind of difficult and tough, but there's something just a little bit... I think smug would be too strong a word, but sort of like... Actually, it's kind of what I think Pip was saying about that puzzle game that was had these secret solutions that was obstinately not clue you into them. That's what it feels like. It's a game that's obstinately not cluing me into any of its secrets, and it expects me to be fascinated and allured to try and find them out, no matter how difficult and tricky that is. And I'm not as allured by it as it thinks I am, and so that just creates like a small amount of like friction. But it is still charming, and I will play more. And then I also played Future Unfolding, which is a game I've been seeing around for years, and I played an early build of it like ages ago, and I didn't really get into it. It's top-down and very colourful and very... it's kind of in natural environments like forests and lakes and stuff, and you're a blue man, and it's an indie game, and everything is...
group?
No, you're alone. No. Blue man alone. Everything is in a very like impressionistic style, sort of feels like brush strokes, and lots of like flat color, not too much like textured detail or anything. And it has this, if you sprint, then you leave like a blue trail behind you. And if you press, I'm playing on a gamepad, and so like I think if you hold A, then you do the sprinty thing with a trail. And if you press B, then a little circle comes out of you briefly. And it's one of those games where like it's never, nothing quite fits into the normal game conventions. You know, I do that and I think, okay, that's the sprint button. But then actually when you run past certain things with the blue trail seems to interact with certain things, like certain flora will sort of recoil from it and some of them will change color and stuff. And then the B thing, I thought it was like sending out a pulse or something. And then I later learned that B is also like how you interact with, how you like talk to, the very few characters that you can talk to. And so it's kind of the use button, but then it was also, it does have another, like that ring does do something sometimes and then things sometimes react to that. And so it's a game where like, it doesn't, break down easily into just, the normal video game controls or conventions. Everything's just a little bit, more, organic. And there's no explicit goal. And it's incredibly uncommunicative about what you're trying to do or what you can do, but it's kind of an open world. Like you just run around and explore it. And there is a map that shows where you have and haven't been, which is quite nice. And the first time I played it, all I figured out was if I dashed past these certain plants, they would like pop and then eventually regrow. And I could tell there was something about if I did it in the right sequence, it had some kind of reaction. I remember like only discovering one thing, like if I do this, then this changes color for some reason. I didn't know why. And there's a bunch of like wolf type things, or I can't remember what kind of creatures they are, that were kept attacking me and I would die. And then the death effect is really cool, but it kind of like punches a hole in the world and then distorts around where you die and then you just restart. But I found it kind of frustrating to not be able to get into it. And this time I discovered way more of the world and there was a lot less threat in this build, it felt like, or maybe it just went in a different direction, but I almost never died. And when I did, it was because it was like, oh, okay, you've told me this thing is dangerous, but I'm going to just walk into it and see what happens. So it's quite a peaceful game, actually a very peaceful game. It's all about just wandering around this like beautiful natural environment. It's really gorgeous. Discovering it. If you just like exploring, then you'll just be happy, I think, walking around it, and doing nothing else. But there are ways to progress that, are also completely mysterious. They're just like, you just find like a blue triangle and when you touch it, one of its sides turns a bit pink. And so you're like, oh, okay, there's probably two more of these and I've got to find the other ones. And then after I get three, an orb appears somewhere. And then when you walk into the orb, you teleport to a different part of the map. And then when you arrive there, a ghost moose talks to you and says something cryptic about the River of Time. And then...
You've really gone some places this week, haven't you, Tom?
It's the IGF, man. It's so indie.
Seen some shit in there.
But actually, yeah, the when the sort of ghost moose talks to you... Yeah. It's the text is just kind of like... I don't know. It meant nothing to me, and... I kind of wished it wasn't there because the rest of the game is wordless, which I only like if the game is brilliant at it. And this one is, like, it's because exploring is fun and because it's such a nice thing to look at. And I'm interested in all these little weird, it has a lot of like inconsequential reactions and interactions where, like I say, you know, your streak turns flowers different colors sometimes. And then sometimes that is a mechanic and you find a line of flowers, and if you turn all of those that color, it kind of points you to another line, and then you do the other line, and then eventually it forms like a giant cross, and then that's marked on your map for some reason, and something else will change in the world. And so that stuff is interesting. And then just through pottering around like that, if you do that enough in a world like this, you eventually discover interactions that are, like, mechanically significant. And, you know, one of them was just, I realized, oh, if I press B near a rabbit, my guy sits down for a while. And at first I thought, okay, it was just kind of cute. It was just like, he communes with the rabbit. He sits down, looks at the rabbit looks at him. And then afterwards I realized that, I've got some rabbits following me. And, oh, I have two rabbits following me. And I did that with two rabbits. And that was me taming the rabbits. And that's the way you can tame rabbits. And then I discovered that if you hit the use key while you're near one of your tamed rabbits, your tamed rabbit creates a bush. And then, you know, so like discovering taming rabbit, well, actually interacting with the rabbits was like, you know, in minute 12. And then discovering that I tamed them was in like minute 20. And then discovering that rabbits can be made to create a bush was in like minute 40. And then like after an hour, I discovered that the bushes that the rabbits create make bees furious. And I've still actually haven't even found a use for this. But you can lure bees to locations by having a rabbit plant a bush there, and then the bees will fly over and they'll actually like destroy the bush. But also, surprisingly, rabbit planted bushes regrow in that same spot even after they've been destroyed by bees. And I was trying to interact with a pink lily to see if that did anything. And what I wanted to do was get a rabbit to plant a bush on it, and maybe it would like turn the bush pink or something, or make the lily do something. But what it did was make angry bees come towards the pink lily. And then I'm like, oh, maybe if I can interact with the pink lily while the bees are over it, it'll like make the bees be good. And that is also not true.
You can't reform a bee.
No. But what I did end up doing was creating like so many rabbit bushes. This is in a lake. I created so many rabbit bushes in the lake, that when the bees came to destroy them, they would destroy the first one, and then they destroy the second one, and then destroy the third one. And by the time they destroyed the fourth one, the first one had regrown. So then they'd have to fly back to the first one. And so I created like an eternal ecosystem of bees destroying rabbit bushes in a lake. And I suddenly thought, huh, this is actually interesting, because they used to hang around in this one particular spot that I couldn't go near because there was bees near there. And now I've created like a permanent distraction so I can go to that place. And I went there and there was nothing there. This is not a puzzle. That's just the thing I did.
You've just created a problem for some bees.
Yeah. But I really enjoyed that, and it was just a kind of, the world is, like I say, just nice enough to be in and reactive. Like, it's just reactive enough that you want to tinker with it, mess around with it. And that is enough that I will eventually discover the mechanics I need to know to progress. Like, this one, what I didn't need to know, but then there's one about, like, how you can interact with the sort of, cattle-like creatures, that it was ages before I discovered it, and it was important to progressing, but I didn't mind that it took me that long, because when I did discover it, it was a really like nice moment, and I wasn't frustrated at my lack of progress. There's always somewhere to like wander around and look at and explore, so it's really cool.
That sounds rad. And also, I have mostly followed everything that you've done in the game this week, but I don't think I've ever had fewer frames of reference.
Yeah.
For exactly, I mean, what you're achieving.
Yeah, I played more than just these games. These are the ones that I liked. And I think I liked them because they don't really relate closely to anything else. Like, the cool thing about these was they're refreshing.
It's not a similar game, like, in any way tonally, but so, like, the thing I played this week that I finally got around to playing is Inside. Well, we spoke about Inside way back when.
Also in the IGF, and was almost became the only IGF game where I voted for it in every category, but I stopped just short of design.
Well, to talk about its design though, like, so, you know, I finally got around to playing it, and so, you know, apologies for possibly retreading some ground that we've covered earlier in the year on the pod, but like this has been the couple of weeks I'm spending making sure that I've played things that I missed. Like I'm going to go around to playing Firewatch this week because I completely missed it. And I probably won't talk about that too much on the pod, but because I appreciate that with narrative thing, it's a bit harder to talk about it.
Yeah.
But the thing that like I remember Limbo for its atmosphere really, and I couldn't remember any of the puzzles in that game like at all years later. But I remembered the sort of the way it looked and felt. And I think this time around I was a little bit more conscious of it as a puzzle game. But more specifically conscious of it as a sort of a really interesting blend of like, yeah, it's a puzzle game. It has bits you could get stuck on, it has stuff you've got to think about. But also it is so committed to presenting everything to you visually, nothing to you verbally at all, whether that concerns what you're expected to do or more specifically why you are doing anything. Like it explains so little. And even though, yeah, I mean, you could say, you know, it tells you the story through its environment, it does and it doesn't. It leaves so much up to interpretation and so much is sort of left abstract that you'd think it would be, you know, not dissatisfying, but that you would sort of want more traction, motivation, you know, some sort of context for, you know, who you are and why you're doing things and why things are happening to you and why you're being mauled by dogs all the time. But actually, I find it really refreshing because I think for me, I didn't go back through and do all of the sort of challenge things you can do, solve all the puzzles to see the alternate ending, because I know I won't really spend that time with it, I don't think. But I really enjoyed it as a sort of, not necessarily a walking simulator, but as an experience that I could kind of trust would never make me do anything other than experiment directly and physically with the stuff that was immediately in front of me in an amazing setting. And I really like that about it. Like there's a nice, because you can't really fail any of the puzzles aside from dying. Like you can die and you can get stuck back, put back to the start of a section. But, we were talking about this the other night. Like, if you can do something in that game, you probably should. Like, the solution, the puzzles are different, and some of them are really inventive, and some of them feel like nicely analog in a way that's not like, oh, you know, initially it is, you need to get up this thing, so we're going to teach you to drag a box, and then you can drag a box and climb and get over the fence or whatever. And later on, you have much more analog solutions to problems, but it's always roughly the same. Like, you always enter an area, you're always moving left to right. And if you backtrack, it's always to get something or to activate something in the level. And you're always essentially tasked with going into an environment, hitting whatever barrier is put in front of you, whether that's an enemy or just a wall or something like that. And then basically taking an itinerary of everything in the environment that moves. If you can move it, if you can pick it up or drag it, whether it's a button that causes something to happen. And then you very quickly piece together the logic of that particular thing, you know, and then you do it. And because there's basically one solution to every puzzle, and despite the kind of pretty abstract places the game goes and some of its more abstract ideas, it has a really, and the fact that it's, you know, very visually varied and environmentally varied, it has at its heart like a really consistent internal logic derived from physics and AI. And I find that really gratifying. Like it doesn't, it never sort of forces you to solve anything other than in a sort of pretty baseline sensible way most of the time. So if you are, you know, being chased, if you are entering an area, like an open, like yard, and there's a dog that's chasing you and you are going to run and you're going to climb a little wall and then sprint across a bit of open ground and jump into a river or something, then you'll find the first time you do it that if you just run in a straight line and climb the little wall and run straight for the river, the dog has time to catch up with you and will always have time to catch up with you because dogs move at X velocity and you move at Y velocity and X is greater than Y. So the
math. Move at dog speed.
Yeah. They move at dog speed. You move at boy speed. And therefore that will always resolve in that same way. And there's no experimenting to be done with like, well, if I run and jump, can I make it? Because the game is really clear about, no, there is something else you're not doing. It's not a kind of small finesse thing. It's like a, you know, how you approach this scenario. And then you learn, oh, the way I do this is I stop in the first area just long enough for the dog to run down into this yard. and then I hop the wall because it's going to take the dog a little bit longer to go around. And that buys me exactly like an extra meter of time in terms of getting to the river that I jump into. And that extra meter is all you need. And it comes together really nicely. Like, I think it is, you know, a very, it's not massively complicated design a lot of the time, but it's so elegant, and the solutions always feel really nice because they almost, they, all they ever do, especially in the sort of pursuit sequences, is extend the amount of time you can survive by just enough to get to the next sequence. And when you start to get sort of comfortable with them and chain them together, it creates these sort of like hair's breadth escape moments. Like, even getting something right feels like you're only just getting it right. And you're kind of moving on to things that plays into the atmosphere of the game as well. And I find that really impressive. I think it's a nice, for me, it's a nice blend of being told a 2 to 3 hour story over the course of a relatively, well, completely linear game that is never like mega challenging. Like, I was never stuck, but also feeling like I'm constantly having to pay attention to the environment and think and kind of intuit what it wants from me, often without having to dip too much into what would a game designer
do. I think it was, I found it to be better than Limbo puzzle wise in terms of just not being annoying. I think it was more trial and error in Limbo, and there is more, actually I didn't complete Limbo, I got to a bit where there's just a whole fuckload of levers and I think conveyor belts or something, or like some big machine, and the puzzle, I don't know if it was especially difficult, but I couldn't figure out what to do, and I was just kind of bored of just pulling levers on some mysterious machine. It didn't mean anything to me. Whereas I loved early on in Limbo the encounter with the spider, where it's still puzzle solving, but it's like also fighting a giant spider in really clever and interesting ways. And kind of ripping it apart limb by limb, and it's kind of terrifying and gruesome. And
that's why it's called Limbo.
Yeah. They call him John Limbo. The way he dismembers his enemies.
They're going to be excellent at Limbo when he's finished.
If it's allowed to enter a Limbo contest without your legs. And inside, it's much smoother, and it kind of... I did hear people complain that it has... like forced failures, or like things where, oh, there's no way to know that except by dying. And I guess like it does a little bit, but it didn't annoy me in the way that I remember Limbo sometimes did. In fact, to your point about like everything inside, like if you can use it, you probably should. I think there was a puzzle early on in Limbo where like there's some kind of pressure plate that, and they can be like, I can't remember how it works, but I think they can be like toggled on off by switches, and there's a switch next to it. And if you press the switch, it turns on the pressure plate, and then you walk on it and you die. And so the puzzle is just don't press the switch.
There's nothing like that in Inside, I don't think.
I did get a little bit annoyed with the sort of timing-based puzzles where there's like a window of opportunity, and like while this thing is safe, you've got to run out and pull this lever or pry this board off or do this thing that takes or crank this wheel, and you don't have enough time to do it all, so you have to just do it a bit, and then you run back in, and then you come back out. And then, some of those I found just a bit tedious.
Some of the timing stuff I think is actually like genuinely quite like risky. Like a lot of it is, but like I'm interested, like I have a friend who loved Limbo but hasn't really played like any other game since. Like doesn't play games really, and you know, was excited to play this and I recommended it to him. But I can easily see it taking somebody who dips in because they love the atmosphere and they love the sci-fi ideas and everything else going on in it, like a long time to get past some of those things. Like I got through it through a kind of understanding of sort of different tiers of puzzle logic and knowing when to think, oh, this is that kind of puzzle, not this kind of puzzle. Yeah. Like a good example of that is, don't know if voice spoilers, but there's a sort of amazing environment with that on a regular rhythm will kill you if you're not in cover.
Yeah.
I love that. The visual presentation of it is brilliant. It sounds amazing.
Something really spooky about it because it's not totally clear what kills you. Like there's just this sting. You see it kill you and you're, but the sound it makes is very ominous.
And, there's a bit where you're given a lever that, and this is obviously minor puzzle spoilers for Inside, but it's been long enough, I think, but there's a lever that you can pull. There's a bit where you can't get up a ladder and then across a thing and down in a place, because there's just not enough time. There's not enough time and you will die. But there is like a big barrier on a rotating armature going in a circle that at different points covers all of those different things. But and you have a lever which is safe to get to, which stops it. And so the first, like, if you play a bunch of games, or even if you just learn this game's internal logic, the first sort of pass of that puzzle is I stop it when it's offering cover halfway between where I am and where I need to go.
Yeah.
Because that is, you know, just the sort of, that's what you do in a video game, right? You've created new cover, which is how you get to the area. But unfortunately, that means that when you get past the first thing, the ladder, you then have no cover with which to get across to and down to the next bit. And you can't get back to the lever. So you can either cover one or the other, you know, areas you need to get through, but not both. And then there's the tier of, like, this is what I mean by slightly analog, like puzzle solving above that, where it feels like more like you're slightly breaking it, where your job is not to stop it, it's to stop it and then restart it again so that it's in sync with the danger.
Yeah.
In a way that it is offering cover in two places, but on a timing, and then it becomes a sort of finesse platform timing thing where you've got to run through one bit while it's covering that and then follow it, or like wait for it to do a cycle and then follow it over the next one. And I think the more literate you are with games, the faster you'll get to that point. But I'm really interested to know if, because I think this game's a really good introduction to that kind of puzzle solving for people who aren't massively game literate, because there are two buttons and it never asks you to read instructions or process rules. It just shows you stuff and encourages you to experiment. But I'd be interested to know if people think that's okay to do in a way. Like, it feels like almost abusing the game logic, even though it is what the developers expect you to do. Because it's so based on sort of risky timing and sort of, you know, just this sort of very and everything feels like a hair's breadth kind of escape when you do pull it off, which I think is brilliant atmospherically.
I really like, without spoiling what they are, I really liked the puzzles that involve headsets.
Yeah, me too.
That was a really nice mechanic. The thing I really like about it is the portrayal of, especially the very start, just seeing these cars pull up and their headlights like shining through the trees, and just sort of instinctively knowing I've just got to hide from these people. They're adults and you're a kid, and they're clearly sort of like looking for you, and there's dogs, and that sense of just like vague threat, like I'm pretty sure they're after me and I don't know why. And it really feels like a way like the fact that the game is wordless and doesn't tell you who you are and why they're chasing you and what's going on kind of mimics or like reflects what it's like to be a kid. Like, you are a kid, and often kids don't know why adults do the things they do. And so the fact that there's no, like, I'll be embarrassed if there is, but I don't think there's like text on the side of the van that says like child hunting service or like, here's why we're looking for you. Because if your character doesn't know why this is happening, then they want to convey that nameless fear of just like, they're just after me. I don't know why they're after me. They're just after me.
There's also kind of like a sort of like dream logic to it. I think Limbo had this as well, where like the way it truncates environments, like you go from forest to cornfield to industry to city to, and you pass through these things completely seamlessly. There are no loading screens or transitions in the entire game. It is one run from start to end. But that coupled with the kind of like, sort of completely, the complete wordlessness of it, and the fact that the threats aren't named, there are no logos on anything, gives it, I think, it reminds me of those, like the cliche dream of you're being chased by something and you run, but you never seem to move. Like that's both Inside and Limbo, I think, for me, until in either case you get to the, and then I did some lever puzzles moment.
Yeah. I actually also really liked when you get to, later on, you're kind of in a, I don't know if you call it a public place, but like a place of work where there's just people all around and they just kind of don't care about you. They just don't really pay you any mind.
But they do look, which is kind of,
And that again feels like sort of how kids, that's another situation kids find themselves in with adults, where like they're not interacting with them, but they're sort of just there and they're not being stopped from being there, but there's something a little bit, you still feel like an outsider. And
I think it's quite important as well that it does let you, it does teach you that some things are wrong by killing you. Because I think like so much of like the sort of the sense of threat and the texture of that game comes from the amount of work that's gone into those really horrible deaths. Like, you could link it to a few of the games. I think Another World is definitely one of them, because like Another World made a thing of showing you how you died. It's not just like, you know, it is the opposite of like Mario going like, and like falling off the level, right? Like, there is like oh shit, like I've just been stabbed by an alien leech and now I'm dead or whatever, right? And it's always a bit sort of horrible, even if it's just the same animation over and over again. And I think Inside manages that really well, because it makes you not want to die, even when, like, doing trial and error stuff against a dog that's going to, like, rip your throat out is never fun. And because it's a child, because it's, like, a sympathetic character who feels like, you know, the game just, you know, the game sets up all this stuff that all these forces arrayed against you, from, you know, strangers hunting you to dogs to industrial machinery that's much bigger than you, and, you know, crazy drops and broken glass and all the rest of it, that it has to deliver on the threat of that stuff every now and then, just to remind you that you're not just, you know, racing a disposable video game character through a hazard course. It's a horrible fucking thing that's happening to a very abstract presented little person. And I find that really effective. That's why I think it's good that sometimes it does have you eaten by a dog before it'll let you progress.
I'm fine with, like, walking into a room and then getting killed in a horrible way and then seeing, oh, that's the threat, so I need to avoid it. As long as it's clear how to avoid it, that's fine. I really liked I think what's happening is mostly just that you're getting tased, but the way it happens is so horrible, where, like, it kind of fires down a sort of spring coil thing into you, and it hits you, electrocutes you, and then also you sort of still attached to it, and it's just like
starts to drag you away. Yeah, there's so many, like, the when you get caught by an adult, it's horrible, like the hand over the mouth getting held down. Like, it's really really well directed, and I don't think you could remove any one aspect of it and not severely damage the entire thing. Like, it requires the animation to be as good as it is, it requires the art direction to be as good as it is, it requires the puzzles to be as often as well designed as they are. Although I do think they're hit and miss. Like, I do think there are some that are really good, some that are really good because they feel a bit chancy, and some that are a bit chancy at the expense of being really good. And if there's one section where you need to basically acquire a certain number of things and get them all to a point to open a door. And it's really clear that there's like four branches of the level, four or five ways you can go. And there is just a correct order to go those ways. And so that was a bit of a pace breaker for me, simply because it reminds me a bit more of those bits in Limbo where you go and pull 15 different levers and sort of, you know, the game could have expressed all of the different sort of aesthetic ideas that it expresses in that section much quicker. But I can understand why they would do like a big area puzzle to show that they can. But the thing I like about the rest of the game is actually something I did mention, is that it almost never reuses too much of many of the same ideas. It just sort of like brings something in, you deal with that for a while, and then it never revisits that, and it's onto something else, and you're solving puzzles in a different way. You know, whether that's like, we're going to have a pressure plate section, and this isn't, you know, the old, you know, puzzle platformer thing of like, we have introduced the pressure plate mechanic, the next level will have pressure plates in it, and the level after that will have pressure plates, and last level's thing until the end of the game. It's just like, okay, we've done pressure plates now. The game is now throwing boxes until we get bored of that, and then it'll be the headset stuff or whatever else. Yeah, so it's great. I definitely recommend it. It was in the Steam sale, but that's obviously no good to people now. But there is another Steam sale coming up, the Christmas one, or so it is rumored. So I think it's a really good candidate for Christmas punt, even though it's the least Christmassy game on planet Earth.
Show your family.
Yeah, exactly. Show your friends that like sort of sci-fi horror and, you know, games that don't look like any other game.
Yeah, I think it is actually quite a good thing to show to non-gamers, because it's so sort of cohesive, just so visually perfect. Like, usually games are just a bit, even if they're graphically flashy, they just don't look like anything except video games. Whereas this sort of looks like a beautiful animated film, or
beautiful 2D side-scrolling animated film, which is a cool idea, right? Like, the other thing I dipped back into is Darkest Dungeon, which I still think is sort of quietly one of the year's best games, just because it's so beautifully designed. But sort of the opposite in some ways of that experience of Inside, because it is, one, a very long experience if you really dig into it and you keep playing it. And two, it's obviously because it's an RPG, it's enormously text heavy, although it's really good text. But something I sort of convinced myself that I was going to boost it up and start a new save and like go on that adventure again. I don't know if this is just sort of how I'm feeling at the moment or if it's changed, but like I had this feeling of after I sort of played for a while and after I had my first real disaster, like a proper everything's gone wrong, fuck up, lost three people, last one had to run away, is now permanently mentally scarred by that and have to send him to the church to flagellate himself until he feels better. I had that feeling of like, I'm kind of done now. Like I've had my darkest dungeon time for now because I know that the game is going to continue to offer cool situations and cool stuff and interesting challenges, but it's going to be kind of more of the same to a greater or less extent for the next however many dozens of hours it takes me to make, you know, real progress and unlock the next area and then the area after that and so on and so on and so on. Whereas kind of what I wanted was like 2 to 3 hours of like a cool voice man saying Lovecraft things at me as I went into a cellar and fought skeletons. And as soon as I had my first, because that game is all about setbacks. It's all about killing you so that you learn to come back and try something differently. But as soon as I got to that point, I was like, cool, yep, I've had the experience now. And that was one of the things I really liked about Inside is, like, played that for 3 hours and I was done.
Mm. Yeah. Would Darkest Dungeon work as a party game? Like, because we're talking about, like, playing FTL.
Oh, yeah, because we did. Yeah, I mean, FTL's definitely a point of reference for it. I think there's too much messing around in town. That doesn't offer a lot to a spectator. Like, it's not like a fun mini game where you send someone to get pissed or go gamble to make themselves feel better. And it's quite, I think because it's a party based, turn based action, you know, combat game when you get into a fight, there's not like, it's not like, so when we played FTL as a party game, the battles in that are very frantic. And quite systems driven, so the ship can catch fire and that's really bad. And and you know, we loved that glaive beam a lot, like really a lot. And you know, people can cheer when the glaive beam like lances through a room in the enemy ship and you can see that their crew is suffocating because he took out the O2 and you know, good stuff. Whereas there is like systems based chants and you know, cool stories that can develop in the middle of a fight, but they're, I don't know if they're the kind of thing that have like enough of a visual dimension to work in that way. Like you can have, you know, someone's stress level can get driven to the point where they have a breakdown and gain a negative trait and that can create situations, but I don't know how meaningful it would be to a group necessarily. Like I suppose that actually, so the way to make it fun would be to name the various adventurers after people who are in the room. So they have the attachment to like what's happened.
Yeah.
Because you do have cool stuff like when those systems start to like play off against each other. So if a character gets the, is it spiteful trait? Or scathing or something like that. It's one of the bad traits you can get. Like most of the time you get something fearful like paranoid or like, you know, they have like some code like again, claustrophobia or something like that. But one of them is basically they just become a dick. And they will sometimes, like, someone else will do their move in the turn-based combat system, and the spiteful character will just say, like, is that the best you can do? That's fucking rubbish. And that will raise the stress levels of that person in the party, and then they start to feed off each other and creates this sort of, like, failure cascade, which I suppose is the thing it has in common with FDL. It's like, well, one thing starts to go seriously wrong.
Yeah.
Everything starts to go seriously wrong. But I don't know how funny that would be to watch unless you had a stake, like, unless you were, I don't know, betting on... like whose character's going to make it or something like that.
Yeah.
Something like that maybe. Something interesting about it is you can have, it's a game about failure cascades, but you basically can't have a success cascade. I think maybe the same is true of FTL, right? You can have a run of good luck.
Yeah.
But in terms of, I don't know, maybe you kind of.
If you get like, if you're lucky in that you happen to get a whole lot of scrap early on and then you also happen to get a shop that sells a good weapon, now you've got a good weapon and you'll do better in subsequent encounters and stuff, and it'll be a bit easier.
That's true, actually. Like Spelunky totally has that as well. Like, I'm just thinking about roguelikes and you know, like, roguelikes, the stories are often, here is the first thing that went wrong, and this is how it led to the second thing that went wrong. Whether that takes place in the span of a couple of seconds, like, I dropped a bomb, but it sent a damsel flying into a shopkeeper who then, you know, killed the tiki trap that I was standing on, or whatever it is, and you sort of tell that story. Or it's the sort of long FTL thing of like, I lost my the only crew member that I could send into the burning O2, so everyone suffocated. But those games also have the stories that start with like, I got a jetpack straight away, and then my entire run, and then I got a shotgun, and my entire, I was then playing like fucking, you know, a jetpack shooter for the rest of that particular game. Whereas Darkest Dungeon isn't a roguelike because it persists after you lose the party. Like, you're supposed to experience these like permanent setbacks, well, in terms of your party members dying, but you keep going. But I don't really feel like you can have success early in the same way.
Right.
I think I'd like it a lot more if you could, actually.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that keeps me coming back to Spelunky and FTL is, even in general, I don't like randomness to be too like dice rolly. Like, I don't like randomness to be, you know, you got a 6 this time, so you do well. I want it to be, you know, mostly skill based, and then randomness to kind of be the flavor. But I definitely notice myself when I'm thinking about, oh, am I going to play another game of this? It's always like, maybe I'll get a really good thing in a crate early on, or maybe I'll get a really good weapon at a shop in FTL. And the fact that, you know, it's a little bit dice rolly, is part of what makes it addictive. It's, you know, it's a gambling.
Yeah, impulse. And it gives each run a different character as well. You don't feel like you're about to replay a lot of the same challenges.
Yeah.
With small things different. You know, when you restart it, like, you know you're going to do the caves or whatever, and you've done that a million times, and you'll start to recognize certain tile patterns and stuff that you kind of know, this is a snake pit. It's going to have these sorts of things in it. But there are enough things that can be substantially different that it's really tempting to restart, because you know that the next run is going to be, or at least has the potential to be, something really new. I think I love Darkest Dungeon. I think it's great. Like, I think it's a great marriage of like systems and presentation, specifically. Like, the voiceover is great and really sells it. And if you were in the mood for like a Legend of Grimrock style, like dungeon crawler RPG that you could sit there for an entire day and sort of plug away at, and then it's fantastic. But I think sometimes it suffers for the fact that if you're not in the mood to really engage with those systems and like, okay, well, this boss wiped me out and I lost 3 of my best people, who do I take on a different mission to get them some stuff they need that will help me eventually go back to that point and do it again? And you're not kind of in the mood for like really repeating some very similar challenges, then I think it loses some of its luster. I mean, maybe comparing it to Spelunky and FTL is like not fair for that reason, because it's more interested in being like a party building RPG than a one-off 20-minute to 2-hour adventure that you'll never repeat. But at the same time, it does regularly take all of your progress away and make you do things differently. It makes me think of XCOM as well, actually. Like, Darkest Dungeon is somewhere between FTL and XCOM, but with a fantasy Lovecraft kind of vibe. And XCOM doesn't really allow for... Does XCOM allow for success? Surprise success?
Yeah, you have to take the long shot, but if you do take the long shot, then you have a chance of making the long shot, you know, the 14%.
Mm, that's true.
We've talked before about, like, I think XCOM snowballs too much. If you are successful, you can be more successful, and if you're not successful, it becomes harder and harder to be successful.
Yeah, and that success is not due to some crazy, often not down to some kind of crazy gambit on your part. It often comes down to, did those long shots come off or not?
Yeah.
Like, was this otherwise routine mission a surprising cakewalk or a surprising disaster? And if it was a surprising disaster, you should probably restart, because...
I feel like the way it usually works with XCOM is that your plan is the best case scenario, and then you do the plan, and then for me, like, the way it usually goes wrong is there was another pod of enemies that was just in vision range, and by moving my guy there, I've aggroed them now, and now I'm fighting 2 at once. And that's the sort of like most common disaster, is I aggro 2 bunch of loads of enemies, and now my plan is shot to hell. And so in that way, like, there isn't a success version of that. It's not like I planned to take out one pot of enemies, then they vanished and there was no enemies, so it was great.
I think, maybe sort of the surprise success in XCOM is something like, you get the perfect first round of Overwatch on a revealed group of enemies, but you weren't expecting it. So you do the Overwatch creep forward thing, because when you reveal a group of enemies, that gives you a chance to shoot at them all for free. And sometimes that's completely useless because the group of enemies will be behind a wall and there's no chance you're going to get drop on them anyway. But sometimes you get the perfect one where you have the three correct squad mates in position, so your sniper, your like heavy weapons person, and someone else all in the perfect places. And then your kind of lead person reveals the group of enemies who are themselves just happen to be in the open, and they get slaughtered because you've caught them when they are maximally vulnerable and you are maximally prepared. Mm. And normally you're somewhere on the continuum with both of those factors. And then the mission is way easier because that was one of the X number of randomly generated encounters it had for you. And you've just bypassed it through basically luck, like caution. Yeah. And some strategic forethought, but mostly the procedural generation gods were with you.
Yeah. It's an interesting thing. I think this idea of sort of the chance of finding an unexpected boon, something that's going to make your life easier early on, is definitely a big part of my addiction to FTL Spelunky. And something like XCOM doesn't have that, and I really liked XCOM, but I haven't replayed it, and I thought I was going to. And in my head, when I imagine replaying it, I imagine just the same campaign again.
Yeah.
Like, not that it doesn't vary, but just that I'm not excited about, maybe when I play it, I'll get some class I haven't had before, or some, you know, item or weapon will fall into my hands that is going to be really fun to use.
Well, that's exactly how I feel about Darkest Dungeon. Like, I thought I went back to it thinking of it as something like FTL. Like, I haven't dipped back into this for a while and go on an adventure. And then having had, like, the mini arc that I now know will repeat itself until I eventually succeed, I'm done. Like, I had fun, but yeah, like, I can't imagine it being crazy different.
Mm.
But yeah, I think next for me is Firewatch and Abzu in my continued march through the short form indie games I nonetheless did not play this year.
I'm going to play Lara Croft Go soon because that's out on PC now.
Mm.
And something else. I've been meaning to play Alpha Protocol for so long. I think I've kept it installed for like a year.
Have you never played Alpha Protocol?
No.
You totally should.
Yeah.
Pants. When it wants to be pants, it's fucking awful. And when it is good, it's really good, but flaky as well.
Yeah. I've only ever heard sort of mixed praise for it. Like, lots of people told me I should definitely play it because I like it, but it always comes with. But it does have...
It's like, you know, they made... Obsidian made Mass Effect and Splinter Cell at the same time, but with that kind of like old school Obsidian, we have loads of good ideas and we can implement five of them at any given time or something's going to collapse. It's definitely worth playing though, because it is like its good moments are really good, and no one else has made an RPG like that. No one else has taken the Mass Effect formula and made it also a stealth game and also just a modern spy thriller.
Yeah.
Like, really without too many other kind of sci-fi trappings apart from the odd gadget. It's Clancy, kind of a Clancy degree of sci-fi, in that there are EMPs.
Right.
And they work. Yeah, it's got some really... The thing I would say, if you're planning to play it, and it's a perfect Steam Cell game again, because it must be like a pound, right, is go all in on like hacking, persuasion, and pistols, which is basically
the three favorite things,
which is basically the James Bond build. Like, I staggered into that by accident. And that is because it is of the generation of RPGs that was pretty happy to like lock off pretty mission critical stuff behind one of two things, either a conversation or someone's fucking laptop password. And hacking and speaking are the two things that will get you through that. And the combat system is genuinely terrible. Like, it's, you know, it's, I think, a contemporary of the first Mass Effect game, and it doesn't have any of the kind of lessons they picked up for the sequels of that, where it's like, we just need to make a good shooter. We make a good shooter and then worry about everything else. The shooting is sort of half RPG, half everything else, but like a silenced pistol shot to the head later on when you've fully upgraded pistol skills will deal with most things that you need to deal with if you're also playing stealthily. Its stealth system is real, real weird.
Looking forward to this.
Yeah, I'd love to see what you make of it, because I think there are things that you are going to really not like. Like, there's a lot of stuff. There are I think mostly avoidable boss encounters, but nonetheless, like, there's going to come a point where your sort of modern spy thriller throwdown is going to have, it is the Deus Ex problem of, like, we can't think of a way of resolving this conflict unless you fight a big man in a room with a lot of pillars.
Yeah, the pillar rooms.
Yeah, like, yeah, and it'll go there. There's some really, really good stuff in it. Sorry, I'm banging on about Alpha Protocol, but yeah.
I know, I'm going to play a load of Dishonored 2 as well.
Yeah.
To be honest, I played that more than I played IGF games in the last week. I played that, like, almost every day, and IGF was one day.
I stalled a little bit, actually. Like, I haven't finished my Corvo run yet. Not through any sort of ill will towards the game. I still love it. But I think I hit a point where I wanted to catch up on stuff, because I felt like if I haven't played that stuff by the end of the year, I'm probably not going to play it.
I thought I was never going to do this, but I'm kind of tempted by the No Powers run now. Because the one thing I haven't done is, I pick a playstyle and I play through with that, and it's always like, I can deal with a situation any of 8 different ways, and I'm going to choose this one in this playthrough because it suits this style. And what I haven't really had is that's the thing of, like, how the hell am I going to solve this problem? Like, just, I think I'm fucked. What can I possibly do? And so a more desperate run might be fun.
I did a No Powers run of the first game, and I really loved it. Like, I loved it more than I expected. Like, I thought it would be, like, fun for a while, and then you'd get bored. But the thing I really like about it is, it doesn't just shut you off from magic. It shuts you off from some of the traditional, like, crutches of Dishonored.
Mm.
So, like, extremely high ledges. Like, extremely high ledges are a very Dishonored, like safety area.
Mm.
So if you go into an unfamiliar or heavily guarded or hostile place, get up somewhere high.
Yep.
And sometimes there'll be threats up there, but most of the time there won't. And you can then, like, it's not a game where you can spot enemies or anything, but mark them, but you can sit there for basically as long as you want and get the lay of the land and consider your approach. And you don't have to be, you know, peeking under threat of being discovered at any moment by a guard coming the other way or something like that. And I found No Powers playthroughs, like, a lot more fluid in some ways, because as long as you're not, like, completely safe scumming everything, you kind of have to be on your toes. And sometimes that means, shit, that guy saw me, crossbow bolt in the neck, as fast as I can do it, because I have no other options. I can't possess him, or blink, or stop time, or mesmerize him, or anything else. It's like, my options are, I shoot him, or I run away, and then try and choke him out. Like, it's really hard to do non-lethal without powers, because you get spotted. Yeah, you can do the combat choke, but then someone else might come along.
Yeah.
And you don't have the repositioning or safety options that you have, so
yeah.
It's like, you have to be amazing at running and jumping and climbing and hiding to successfully choke out all 6 guards that are chasing you, because they're not going to let you do that if they get a chance. So yeah, I really recommend it, which is weird because the power is, like, the best thing about that game. It's also yeah. amazing if you switch them off.
And particularly, like, Blink and Far Reach, just mobility powers. When I switch between, like, Dishonored and another, I didn't play it, but I was just watching old videos of Far Cry 4. Watching it seems so slow in comparison, because, like, after you've decided this is where I want to be, then you have to walk there. It takes time. Whereas in Dishonored, it's just, I want to be there, I'm there. And I always thought that was, like, Dishonored's great invention. The reason it clicked so well and felt so slick was that it just made stealth fast instead of slow. Like, if you wanted to be, like, once you know what you want to do, you can do it quickly because of Blink.
Mm. But it also has amazing traversal systems anyway, like the running and the sliding and jumping really and mantling's great. Like, so there's enough gratification in just climbing and figuring out a route through levels by looking at what you can reach. I've seen there's a great video by the most famous Dishonored high skill YouTuber, which is Stealth Gamer BR, which is a no magic, all lethal run through the Golden Cat where he kills everybody. And it's a bit grim because he kills everybody. He kills all the civilians. He kills all of the prostitutes in the brothel. And in some cases, towards the end, he, like, misses one. And so he just goes back and kills her and walks on. It's like, I don't think it was really necessary. So that, like, damages the video a little bit for me. But the sort of fluidity of his understanding, even though he doesn't have any powers, he does use the double jump, which I do feel is a power.
Yeah, that's, I was thinking, like, I was thinking, if I'm not going to have blink, could I have the double jump? No, that's a
part. So, you know, the first game, you can't progress past the water lock in Dunwall Tower in the fifth mission without either blink or double jump. And when I said this in a video I did, I said, you know, this playthrough actually kind of comes to an end there because you can't progress unless you pick up double jump just to get past that bit. Someone was like, no, double jump's not magic. I was like, yeah, it is. Like, there is no human
it's
alive.
It's not physics.
Yeah. You can't jump twice in the air. Video games have always been able to let you do that. But that's it. I mean, I'd love to know, like, someone should let us know if, you know, the first instance of someone establishing double jump, even as a concept.
Yeah.
Because it makes no sense. You can't just decide to go a bit higher.
I think for the reason it exists as a game design thing is because I actually don't like it usually, or I don't like the physics of it. I kind of want to know, where does the force come from? Why aren't I just jumping much higher in the first place? If I, like, why isn't the power just my jump now goes twice as high? And the reason for that, I think, is that you might not want it to go twice as high. Sometimes you only want to jump a little way, and it would feel annoying if you were forced to jump the full strength. And so you've either got to basically, like, the easiest way to do it is to have the player indicate after they've jumped, would you like to continue going up? Yeah. or are you ready to come down now?
More jump, YN.
Yeah. And physically, you can't do that because, you know, there's no version of that that makes physical sense, because in real life, you have to decide before you leave the ground how high you're going to go. Yeah.
It's fine if you're wearing, like, a jump pack or something.
Yeah. I think, am I imagining it, or does one of the Jedi Knights have a kind of, like, charge-up force jump?
Yeah, it has, it's a...
Because one of them doesn't, I think. There's one where you just hold jump and you keep going up while you're holding it, but I think one of them...
Yeah, there's like a sort of force floof.
I can't remember which order it came in, whether they refined it to charge up.
I think it's Academy that has the charge, because it has a bunch of moves that sort of spin off that. Another great charge jump is Prototype.
Oh, yeah.
Which is the one where if you... Saints Row 4 as well, actually. That has the... I think that's the game with the jump where if you like charge it for long enough, like the ground starts to shake and stuff starts to... like collapse around you before you like rocket into the sky. Good charge jumps.
I remember the thing I remember from Jedi Knight was, and again, I don't remember which one it was, but charging up a jump in like a corridor and just smashing my head on the ceiling, and it actually hurts you.
Like, I don't know what I expected to happen.
You take, I wouldn't call it fall damage, but you take some kind of damage.
Collision with environment.
Yeah. Head on ceiling damage.
Yeah. So not something you'll ever see in a Star Wars movie. They're definitely a lot more subtle than that, ish. But yeah, I don't know how we got onto that from...
There's a long path there.
Dishonored. Yeah, Dishonored is extremely good because you can switch off all of the things that are good about it and it gets better.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm actually really... I kind of want Corvo to be done. Not that I'm not enjoying it, but it's kind of like I've committed to it now.
I really,
so that I can play no powers Emily.
Yeah, I'm going to do Emily for no powers run, partly because it doesn't matter, like, which character you play as. And I think it's narratively more interesting. Like, I like the idea. I don't know what exactly the explanation is, but for some reason, when she's offered the powers, she's like, no, I saw what happened to my father. And for some reason, she doesn't want that. Like, maybe there's some, she thinks it changed him or.
Yeah. Or she doesn't trust the spooky floating man.
Yeah. Just it's a very sensible thing to say no.
Yeah, yeah. Also, like, yeah, like, I justified my no powers run through for the first game by saying to myself that Corvo just had a weird dream. Like, so if you have a weird dream and you wake up with a tattoo you didn't have before you went to sleep.
It's a very weird dream.
That's weird. But just because you had a weird dream where you could teleport doesn't mean that in real life you would assume you could teleport. So I suppose the only way to do a no powers playthrough of the first game is that Corvo does have powers because you do have them. But why the hell would he assume that he has magical powers? Just because he occasionally has hallucinations of a floating magic man that tells him off. But I really like you can do it, and I agree. I think it makes a lot more sense for Emily to be the one rejecting the powers because Corvo has powers at the start of the game. Yeah. And obviously you could say, like, no, I'm done with this, but he knows how rad they are.
Should we do questions?
Yes.
Good.
Excellent.
The first time I asked, the answer was no.
The first time you asked, the answer was, can you record it again? I clicked the mouse really loudly. Little peek behind the curtain there to the glamorous world of pretending that 20 minutes haven't passed.
Yeah, Quentin Crowbar's worst kept secret. That,
yeah, indeed.
That there is a break in the middle.
Yeah. One day, we will just record the break and all of the hilarious libelous things we say during...
This time it's really just an excuse to talk about Dishonored 2 for like another half an hour without feeling like it's dominating the podcast.
Yeah, some good Dishonored 2 chat as well. Like, you know, there were some moments in that I was thinking, damn, yeah. But this is why when we talked about Dishonored 2 in the spoiler cast, we did so for three straight hours without a break.
We talked about it at the pub last night as well. For like,
yeah, probably an hour. Until everyone else left and then get to Dishonored 2. Probably do another Dishonored spoiler cast, to be honest. Like, we don't...
Or maybe when Tom and Pippa finished it.
Yeah. Let's not promise this.
No.
But no, seriously, you know, maybe when I thought we were launching a series of one-off side pods, we were actually just launching a separate Dishonored 2 chat therapy system. It's an extremely good game.
Mm-hmm.
Bone charms are interesting. Anyway, questions. Kane writes, question unlocked, symbol crash. I tried Titanfall 2 recently, and at the end of the match, I was accosted by 100 achievement screens flying up into my face to the sound of deafening, high-pitched, crashing noises. I saw a skip button, which I started frantically clicking in an attempt to stop the barrage, but apparently that just meant skip to the next unlock screen. Every time I clicked it, I got another flashing screen and another loud noise. It was a horrible experience. In For Honor's Alpha, the same thing happened, and while I've been out of multiplayer FPSs other than Titanfall 1 for a decade, I'm given to understand this is a cancerous growth common to many of them. Why? Why? Do video game publishers think that it's the only way to hold our attention after a match ends? Do they think the instant the gunfire stops, we'll immediately hit Alt-F4 and flee unless they present us with a bunch of swooping images and the sounds of a child inexpertly drawing a knockoff katana from a metal scabbard in an abandoned construction site, swinging it and knocking over a pile of rusted iron pipes? Breathe. Whatever happened to having a moment of quiet reflection between matches? Whatever happened to restraint? Level up, trumpet noise. Kane.
I don't think I ever had a quiet moment of reflection between matches.
No, mostly just waiting for the next level to load.
Yeah, I was always incredibly impatient. I don't play a lot of like competitive shooters, but I did notice that Metal Gear Solid 5, every time I complete a mission, would bombard me with a huge amount of things, and I kind of liked it. Mm. It gives you like a grade that is based on your performance, and that's obviously like, you know, not cheap.
And then an animal that is inexplicably associated with your playstyle.
Yeah, you get an animal associated with that. And then it also, I think it like goes through all the people you unlocked, even though you already know who you unlocked because, you know, the people you Fultoned out tells you about them. And that's just kind of reminding you about something that you achieved and saying, hey, look, you achieved this thing. And then I can't remember what it is, but there's a deluge of stuff that isn't really meaningful, but you just sort of unlock it. And a load of them are, I think, like, titles or sort of accolades. It will just pop up saying you're in this title and this accolade or whatever, and I never know what they are exactly, but I remember noticing, like, even though this means nothing to me, I feel kind of good.
Yeah.
It's just being showered with praise.
So, I mean, this is, you know, like, I hate to say this, Kane, but I really like the Titanfall 2 end of match, you know, bonanza, because it is a bonanza. There's no other way to describe it apart from apparently as a disaster. And the reason I like it, like, for example, I really hate the way DICE have gone with this exact system for the Battlefield games and Battlefront, because they're mega stingy. And everything is pretty much like one progression path. I think Battlefield 1 does this slightly better, but Battlefront is really bad for this. There's like one progression track, and it's your level. And it goes up not a lot, like at all, every match. So every match you see like your results and the score screen and stuff. And then, I mean, Kane may even like this. The moment where it goes like, and you've made like, you know, 10% progress towards the next level, and it just goes, and it stops, and the bar doesn't fill up all the way, and sometimes it's infuriatingly close to done, at which point you have to play it again. Overwatch does something similar, actually. Everything's tied on your level, and sometimes you get loads of bonuses if it's your first win of the day, and otherwise it just creeps up a little bit, and it's really depressing. I think Titanfall does really well, I think, is it's measuring like 8 different types of progress at the same time. It's not as absurd as Metal Gear, where it is measuring how stealthy were you, how lethal were you, how accurate were you, what animal are you, what school grades do you get for that?
What animal named people did you capture?
Yeah, exactly. What people arrived and did you find any copper? Right. But Titanfall will track your overall level, but your overall level is increased by collecting like commendations that you get from loads of sub achievements. Which is everything from, like, did you extract successfully at the end of a losing match to did you win? to were you in the top percentage of players, to did you level up your gun in that game, because your gun has its own progression track, your Titan has its own progression track, and the faction that you are arbitrarily aligned to that determines only who shouts in your ear during the game have their own progression track, and all of those things can independently prestige. And so, yeah, it sounds possibly like the worst thing ever, but it goes full circle, and I believe has become the best thing. Because all I want at the end of a shooter is for someone to, like, walk into my room with an old-timey cash register and just shake it, like, up and down until all the bells go. And it's great.
I always wondered, with TF2, which is probably the last competitive shooter I was really into, I didn't like... it had achievements and it had records. So you'd be told, oh, you're close to your record for kills that round as a heavy. And that quickly becomes useless to you because after a certain point, you almost never break any records as anything. All my records are sort of freakish, weird things where, like, I was on a test server and 17 people ran in front of me. And so you never get close to that, so you just stop getting told that you're any good at all. And I always wanted it to be, like, at the end of the match... they're pretty good at, like, having all these metrics for what you did. And what I want to be told is, that was the most kills you got as a heavy in the last 2 months or the last week. And sometimes it'd only be in the last 2 days. But I imagine there's probably in any given game, it's probably always something that you did better than you've done in recent memory.
Yeah.
And it could just tell you, if it's always just, that was the best in X period of time. That period of time could be short sometimes, and sometimes it could be long, but it would always be a positive thing, and it would always be true, and it would always actually reflect something you did.
You died the fewest times within the first 5 minutes of the game that you had recently. There's an amazing Dota stat tracking website called Dota Buff that does exactly that in a really good way. Obviously, it doesn't do it in the game client, it does it outside of it. But that's a really... because that uses the API... allows it to extract match data, incredibly detailed match data, including movement patterns and stuff like that from every game ever played. So it has this nuts database. And they bolted on a completely arbitrary achievement system. There's like thousands of achievements that they've written. But it means that even if the game itself very rarely returns any kind of like reward, because it's Dota and everything's mega hardcore, that website is always telling you, like, actually, like, the three highest... gold per minute games you've ever played were last week, 6 months ago, and the month before that.
Wow.
And, you know, you can sort of, like, you know, compare all these interesting things. They added recently, like, a much more detailed stat screen to Dota. And there's one thing which I love because it's not really useful information at all. It's in this vein, except occasionally it serves to make you feel really bad, which is that after a game, whether you won or lost, you can click on your hero and see a whole bunch of stats, like loads of stats, like, because it's a game of stats. But one of them is, how good was this performance on this character relative to your average performance on this character? And it's just the character's little face on a bar that goes from green on one end to red on the other end. And if it's an average performance for you, you'll be in the middle. And if it's better than average, you go towards the green. If you're worse than average, you go towards the red. And it is, I've never noticed it. I've never, like, consciously noticed it when I've, like, played really well and it's been a better than average performance. You always notice it when you play really well, and then it tells you, that's actually pretty subpar for you on this character. Or when you play really well, or you play really badly, and then it's like, that was average for this, for you on this character. That was normal. And you feel terrible about it because you're terrible. Or worst case scenario, you play really badly, and then it's like, that was actually better than you normally do.
Battlefield 2 would sort of record always... I can't remember what it told you at the end of a match, but it would also, on their website, you'd have a profile page and it would tell you your whole lifetime stats. And it was incredibly depressing because I feel like I was pretty good at Battlefield 2. I'd always be high on the scoreboard and I was a medic who would both do my job as a medic but also get, you know, as many kills as the people who are playing Assault and stuff. But then, like, I had a bunch of accolades to my name in terms of, like, ribbons and medals and shit and how many games I've been top of the scoreboard and how many things, but in terms of actual overall win percentage, I think it was 49%. It's like, after all that work, it's slightly worse to have me on your team than to not have me on your team.
I am exactly that in Dota. I have, like, a floating 49.8% win rate that I've never quite cracked into 50 over the course of thousands of matches. And yeah, it's depressing because ultimately, at the end of it all, I was a liability.
Like, it's within the margin of error. Like, it may be that you are actually a good thing, but there's an error of some kind.
Like, the jury's out.
Yeah, if there's going to be a margin of error, I want to be in the above 50. I want to be able to believe that.
You want it to be there's an outside chance that you're actually shit rather than an outside chance that you're not actually shit.
Yeah.
But long story short, just throw them at me. Just tell me I did well.
Like, unlock it all.
Like, and I'm all right at Titanfall 2. I'm normally at the top of the scoreboard, but that doesn't matter. I want my gun to now be pink.
I
hate that.
I have 995 Overwatch currency, and there's a skin I want that costs 1,000, and I've played it a whole bunch since that point, and I've leveled up a whole bunch of times since then, and I've never got any money, and I've never got anything I've already got. I've got a lot of stuff, so usually you get some kind of dupes, and if you get a dupe, then it gets converted into money, and I just need 5. I just need any money at all, and it never comes. And I was going to play it again, and then they introduced, like, the Olympics thing, and so all the loot is completely unique and new, so there's no chance of getting a dupe, so I'm definitely not going to get any money.
Don't worry, there's been, like, 2 events since then. You'll be fine. You get nothing but... I get nothing but old shit I've already got.
Mm.
So
yeah, everyone else is complaining about the dupes they get, and I'm like, I wish I got a dupe.
I think they slightly jumped the shark with Overwatch cosmetics. I know that's not really the point or any of the subsequent questions we've got, but...
For, like, the Olympic stuff, or...?
No, the Olympic stuff was fine, because Overwatch already had, like, a weird Street Fighter-y, hyper-real nationalism. Not nationalism, but, you know, like, every character had a nation and... was somehow vaguely representative of their country in the manner of Street Fighter. So having, you know, Tracer dressed up in Union Jack is fine. You know, like, D.Va in a Korean flag mech, fine, cool. It's set in the real world, why not? But, like, the Halloween stuff, like Reinhardt's a ghost, you know, Pharah's a zombie. There are, like, victory poses for all the characters, which is their hand coming out of a grave. People are still using all this stuff, so you know you get to the victory screen, and, like, half the people are dead. Huh. Like, it doesn't expire at the end of the event. So, like 90% of the Reinhardts I see now are ghost Reinhardt. And there's something about that. I know if you play a lot of other online games with skins, that's completely normal. If you play League or Heroes of the Storm or something, you're used to the crazy versions of characters being normal and they're being, like, you know, whatever, pirate kind of skins or, you know, astronaut variants or whatever. And, you know, that being completely normal. But I'm used to Dota where everything is... looks basically the same, but you spend thousands of dollars on it anyway. I don't know what's wrong with me, to be honest, but yeah, anyway. Moving on. Mark writes, greetings, custodians of the Great Crowbar. I really enjoy your podcast. It always goes to the top of my podcast queue when it's released. In the last podcast, you asked why tapping on fish tanks was bad for the fish. I got really excited because this is one of a handful of things my university education taught me. Other than the fact being the pandas poop around 48 times a day, and we have no idea how many prions are too many. Most fish have a swim bladder which controls buoyancy. These gas bladders are sensitive to vibrations and rupture easily, killing the fish. So now you know. Christ. Also, since I feel the need to question to justify using the questions email, strange weather we're having, eh? Best regards, Mark.
It was warm today, and that was good because I had problems with my heating and plumbing and I had to turn my heating off, and I was appreciative that it was warm.
Yeah, it was unseasonably warm.
That's interesting about the fish.
It is, yeah.
I wasn't, when people said don't tap on the glass, I wasn't like, oh, why are you, that's weird. Like, it seemed logical to me that it would annoy the fish. Like, it would be annoying if someone tapped on our world and the fabric of our reality
on the world. Yeah. But something inside you wouldn't explode.
Yeah, I hopefully if someone tapped on the fabric of our reality and the whole world shook, my bladder wouldn't explode. I can't say for sure.
Just be insult, well, be injury to insult, really, wouldn't it? Scott writes, The Witcher 3 was released in May 2015. 4 months before that, in November 2014, Dragon Age Inquisition was released. 2014, fucking hell. How is Dragon Age Inquisition 2 years old?
Yeah, that's weird.
Oh no. Anyway, I think I've fallen into a time tunnel. Anyway, when I never came close to finishing Inquisition, I felt that it was probably a good video game. I think it could have been better in the grand scheme of things, were it not overshadowed by the unexpected mainstream success of The Witcher 3. A similar unfortunate scenario has played out recently with the release of Titanfall 2, shortly before COD Infinite Warfare. My question is this. Can you think of another prominent past examples of a good game being lost in the shadow of a similar higher profile game? Are there any that you're particularly bitter about? Yes, I do realize that I've asked two questions. Please forgive me and thanks for potting, Scott.
Yeah, so Titanfall 2, I mean, Titanfall 2's release date was ill-advised. I think we all sort of saw that and it didn't sell well. But then also, I don't know about Battlefield, but like COD didn't sell well either. So it wasn't like Titanfall lost out because COD was dominating the sales. It was just everything kind of did badly. And it's kind of interesting that that's the game that he cites because, I mean, in my little bubble echo chamber, no one really talked about COD at all. And we talked a bunch about Battlefield and we talked lots about Titanfall 2. Like that's kind of the highlight of the shooters. And reviews as well, like reviews really glowing for Titanfall and I think pretty middling for COD. And I quite like the new COD. I think it's the only COD that's interested me in quite a long time.
Good clipboard.
Sorry?
Very good clipboard.
Yep. A clipboard worth running to repeatedly, it's
extremely
even though it's
heavy
really
clipboard.
And I don't really have an answer for it, but I feel like Far Cry Primal was overlooked. Not because it was overshadowed by some other game, but it's quite interesting. There's Reddit are doing like an end of year threads for like, what did everyone think of this game this year? And Far Cry Primal came up, and so I read virtually the whole thread because I'm starved for people talking about or caring about that game, which I love. And there were a bunch of people who liked it and some people who were kind of like half-hearted about it, but just no one responded to any of the things. No one mentions that it's beautiful, and I think it's staggeringly beautiful, and no one mentions stealth at all. They're just like, oh, I liked it, but then like when I played on survival mode, it really bothered me. The enemies took like 4 hits, and that made the combat really just take a really long time. And I'm like, I'm sure that is annoying and boring, but like, why are you in outright combat? Why are you not doing takedowns on everybody? Like,
Saber-toothed tiger pal that's doing it for you.
Yeah. If I get into like a straight out fight in Far Cry Primal, I'm like, I just let myself die and then respawn and do it all over again. And do it perfectly this time. Like the whole game is about stealth in a like amazingly beautiful place. And, for some reason that did not register with hardly anybody.
I think the only example of this that stands out recently is, and it's a hard one because like, it's such a specific question in some ways, but, I really, really liked Faria, which was a free-to-play card-based strategy game, a bit like Hearthstone, but on a hex grid. So a little bit more complicated than the sort of strict lanes. And it got very much overshadowed, I think, by Duelist, which is a very good Hearthstone-style collectible card battle game on a square grid. They have some similar ideas and some very different ideas. I think they both coexist. But ultimately, I think that might be because Duelist is a bit better, which is makes it less of a kind of unfair overshadowing, more that like, and it's a shame that both of them can't be equally well regarded, but maybe it's because one of them is a bit better than the other one.
Yeah, it's just reminded me that actually, not due to similar release dates, but well, kind of, Mankind Divided would be getting a lot more of my attention and love if Dishonored 2 hadn't come along in the same year. I think it's a good game, and in many ways it improves on Human Revolution, and I don't like the story, and I've sort of said why, but in terms of like level design, and I think the problem is the two things it's really brilliant at Dishonored 2 is also incredibly brilliant at, which is level design, but in terms of like the layout and structuring, giving you loads of options and multiple paths and stuff, and visual level design as well, like just stunning places and gorgeous scenery and amazing architecture. And those are both things that Dishonored 2 does like at least as well as Mankind Divided. So like its specialty, it got outshone with.
But again, that's not like sort of like unfairly overshadowed.
Exactly.
Or like, yeah, someone else just did it better. Yeah,
it's I'm the one like letting this overshadowing happen. Like,
yeah, yeah. A person on the internet writes, "Dear Cratium and Crobarnum, games like Neptune's Pride and Subterfuge are renowned for how stressful and anxiety-inducing they can be, a style of game in which, in lieu of a better term, and taking inspiration from a certain pod member I'll henceforth call Friendship Fracturing Strategy. I think you've all had first experience with FFS games. See what you did there. And so in similar line of thought to episode 168's discussion about games' potential as exposure therapy tools, do you think these FFS games or an adapted version could be used in psychotherapy to help those living with anxiety disorders develop tools to manage their anxiety? Thanks for the always ace pod and all the wonderful work of all of you do outside the cast. As ever, it's a consistent bright spot each week and all the more invaluable in a year that's been severely lacking bright spots.
Aww. Aww, thanks.
Aww. Yeah, cheers, person on the internet. I don't know if trying to help someone deal with their anxiety issues by putting them in, like, the most relationship fracturing, like, in a game that will actively reinforce the notion that people are only your friend because they want to undermine you and take your stuff,
yeah,
is a good idea. Because I worry that while, yeah, those games do expose you to anxiety in ostensibly a safe environment, because they are multiplayer games played with your real friends, like, they're fun because they encourage friends to dick each other over. They're also horrible because they encourage friends to dick each other over. If you have an anxiety disorder that means that you are concerned disproportionately a lot of the time that your friends aren't really your friends, maybe that is literally the worst thing you could do.
Yeah. I don't know if it would help therapeutically, because I don't know if I can vouch for, like, aversion therapy, but when you talk about games that make you feel anxious, two games spring to mind. One is Supreme Commander, because it's a strategy game where you have, well, like, literally 500 to 1,000 units in a battle, and you have to balance your economy really delicately, and there are so many different types of units you can build that it is completely overwhelming at all times. But I love it for various other reasons. And so I just had to learn to cope with being overwhelmed. And it was a thing where, like, my instinctive response is like, ah, God, I can't do it. And then you just sort of sit down and think, ah, I'm just going to do it. I'm just going to, like, deal with this and learn to sort of, like, compartmentalize and, like, cut off parts of your brain. Just say, like, this thing that I could be worrying about, I've just got to not worry about it. Not because it's not going to be a problem, not because I'm sure I'm safe, but just because I need to manage my attention. And my attention is a limited resource. And I'm deciding to spend it on my base right now. And I'm going to just make my base really good. And I'm going to build the thing I want to build. And if there's threats coming in, then I might be fucked, but I've just got to cope with that. And then in a similar vein, the other one is Rainbow Six Vegas, which is tactical shooter. Not like radically different to other tactical shooters, but just has a perfect cover system and just really good punchy weapons and randomly placed enemies who also roam around a lot. And so it's, you can't learn the levels. You can learn the levels, but you can't learn the placement of the enemies. And so every time you enter a room, it's, you cannot know where the enemies are coming from. And you can, you know, check your sectors and do good practices for, like, making sure you check the right places, but you can never cover every exit in the time that it would take an enemy to shoot you. So there's always going to be parts of the room where there could be an enemy there. And if there is an enemy there and you don't choose that as the first place to look, they will shoot and kill you. And if you try and check all of the places an enemy could be, you won't check any of them thoroughly enough. And so you'll sweep the room and you'll miss something and they'll kill you. And so the only way to do it is just to accept that you can't cover all the bases. You can't check every possibility and just say, I'm going to check the left side of the room well enough. And if they're on the left, I will shoot and kill them. And if they're not on the left, I will die. But that's the risk I've got to take.
Yeah, that's a nice way to think about it, actually. I think I've gone through some processes of the games, but I don't think I can name them. I think StarCraft, maybe, give me some of the experience, your experience as Supreme Commander, which is sort of accepting that within certain parameters I was only going to achieve so much. But that was in a multiplayer context, where that was also about coming to terms with the fact that I'm a bronze player. And that's not really going to change, ever. Just going to disable my phone. So it probably stops doing the awful microphone thing it did because I forgot to put on airplane mode. And if it didn't do that, and that was a non sequitur, shit. Dan writes, Dear Creighton Bucket, my brother just turned 40 this year and he's working hard to stave off the ravages of age. Part of his routine is playing Doom while pedaling on a stationary bike. He says it's quite physically taxing. To me, it sounds like an accident waiting to happen. Surely there must be other games better suited to play while monotonously pounding on a treadmill. Or riding a bike. Thanks for the great pod. I like listening to it while riding on my stationary bike. Cheers, Dan.
A couple of cycling brothers there.
Just love it.
To be honest, Doom sounds quite good to me for that. I remember hearing about someone who hooked up his stationary bike to World of Warcraft so that he had to pedal to get anywhere. And so when you're just walking across the land, like, he had to cycle to move. And if he didn't cycle up to a certain speed, he would be moving at less than his maximum movement speed.
Right.
Which sounded quite cool. But I guess the only problem with that is then I suppose you've got to stop exercising when you don't want to run.
Yeah. When you want to stop and talk to a shopkeeper or something.
Yeah.
Or fight.
I always think of, like, when you want a game to kind of distract you, that I always think of Bejeweled. Because I remember someone, I can't remember if it was like a podcast question or if I just read about it, but someone saying they're in hospital with like a condition that caused them constant pain, and the only thing that they could, that took their mind off it, was to play Bejeweled Infinite, the infinite mode in Bejeweled 2 or 3 or something, where it just never stops, like, it, and it always ensures that the gems it drops leaves you with some matches, and you never get into a stuck situation. You could just literally play continuously forever, and there's no breaks, and there's no kind of like anything like that. And so it's like the ideal thing to distract your brain, because Bejeweled is really good. Like, swapping gems is there's a reason that like 30% of mobile games are just that.
Yeah.
So it does work to like engage the brain, and if you're doing something monotonous, I think you maybe don't want something that's totally immersive and is going to occupy all of your brain. You kind of want something that's just going to stop your brain from getting bored.
I feel like, yeah, I was going to go with like Hearthstone, Duelist, a bunch of other like sort of minimally physically demanding competitive games. And the reason specifically to go to, because obviously if it's a, you know, something you can play on a tablet or whatever, then it's a little bit easier to play while exercising. But the reason to go with something that is sort of online and competitive rather than single player is because it is a constantly different challenge. And it requires you to think constantly.
Mm.
And for me, like, I don't actually want to zone out when I'm exercising. I want to be thinking and be challenged to think sort of fluidly in a way that distracts myself from the fact, yeah, that my body is doing monotonous physical stuff. Because, like, you know, Bejeweled for me is like, yeah, it helps you zone out. But I don't know. I don't know if I would necessarily, I mean, maybe it's different people to respond differently. But for me, it wouldn't necessarily like distract me from the fact that my body is also doing something monotonous. Whereas if I'm having to, like, you know, even though, you know, Hearthstone is kind of samey, like, you have a deck, you know how to play it, you're still going to be reacting to totally unpredictable new situations on account of having another human player playing against you. Whereas, yeah, I think I'd rather be trying to solve those problems on the fly and clicking new game and trying to rank up, you know. I think that'd be an interesting thing to do, actually, would be to try and, like, can you get to legend rank in a month while cycling every day or something like that. I'd definitely do that. In fact, that sounds like a really good idea. Next question comes from Fool of a Took, who writes, should player characters have voices or not? Thinking more about Corvo in Dishonored versus Dishonored 2.
Yeah, I might be alone in this, but I don't like Stephen Russell's, I don't like his performance of Corvo, and I don't like his performance of Garrett. I don't know what else he's done, but those two, I find them, I like Emily's voice in Dishonored, but I think there's a certain kind of like video game voice acting that is kind of just sounds like acting to me. It always sounds like a voice that's being put on.
They're quite stagey performance.
Yeah. And that always rubs me the wrong way. So I kind of preferred it when Corvo was silent. But like I say, I like Emily's voice, and the fact that she talks, it's cool because I think actually it works better for her anyway, because she's kind of more of a human character than Corvo. Like, you know, Corvo's fine as a character, but he's kind of, he's a badass swordsman who, basically murders people. And so it's fine for him to just say nothing. Like, that makes sense for him. Whereas Emily is established as this conflicted character who's kind of charged with ruling a kingdom and not really ready for it. We knew her as a child. She's very human. She's got a lot to her. It would be kind of weird if she just became this completely silent killer.
Particularly because you'd heard her speak before as a kid. Yeah. It'd be weird if, yeah, she grows up to inherit her dad's trait.
Yeah.
not saying anything for a month.
And I also like that what she says is so different depending on how you're playing. It is simplistic, and it commits the minor sin of putting words in the player's mouth, in that if you have killed a bunch of people instead of taking them out non-lethally, that the game reads that as, oh, you'd like Emily to be a murderous psychopath and say creepy things on every occasion, which is not always true. But the creepy things she says are just like so... I just found them enormously entertaining. She would just like say such dark shit at no prompting. And I really kind of liked Dark Emily. She's such a kind of entertainingly morbid character.
Yeah, I think my answer to this is... It is kind of the boring cop-out answer, but it's kind of like, it depends. There are definitely, like... I like the shift to voice acting in Dishonored 2. I think I agree that Stephen Russell's performance of Corvo is stagey. I don't mind that so much. But it might well... I'd have to listen to them side-by-side. I think it might be a little bit at odds with the performance of Emily, which is a little bit more naturalistic.
Mm.
And I agree. I don't know if that's just because Emily as a character is more believable than Corvo at this point, because you're sort of asked to... Because he's a character with a shitload of lived experience, but hasn't previously spoken about any of it.
Yeah.
So suddenly hearing that voiced is sort of notable. But yeah, like, I think, other games this year, like, Doom didn't need a voiced protagonist, and it's completely respectable that they're not, but that's because the game is supposed to be about a kind of monolithic force of nature that only exists to punch demons in half.
Yeah, and it's true to Doom 1, which was from an age when in an action game a protagonist would never speak. It was always just like silent murders.
I think of them, I would have been perfectly happy if Cooper, I think it's Cooper in Titanfall 2, never spoke. Who's the main dude in that? Because
I can't remember anything he says.
No, but he does speak. He doesn't speak very much. And that's part of one of the problems is because he doesn't speak enough to have like a real opinion about stuff. And you kind of have the proxy voice of the player in the form of BT. And BT is quite a lot like Dog from Half-Life anyway. Yeah. He is like combination Dog and Alex in a single character. And I'd kind of have been happy for him to do all the talking for you in some ways.
Yeah.
He'd just be the quiet rookie. It feels like it's a contender for a game where you don't even really need a name as the main character. All of the pop beats in that game would work just with characters talking around you rather than with you needing to talk. But at the same time, I wouldn't say necessarily detracts from the game.
I don't know if this is a trend, but I feel like there are much more protagonists who speak, whose voices I like these days, particularly women. So obviously, like, Femme Shep is the, I think the first game protagonist where I loved the performance, like noticeably loved the performance, and it made me more immersed in the world rather than less. And since then, I feel like we've had a lot of, I don't know if they're inspired by her, but like one of the female voices in Saints Row 4 and maybe 3 is, one that sounds a bit like Jennifer Hale to me, and is just very like, just a kind of like a very commanding performance, just like someone who really knows who she is and knows what she thinks about things and is not kind of hesitant and uncertain. And that's the thing I really didn't like in a lot of games, is like the protagonist, because the player needs to know a bunch of information, they have the protagonist ask loads of questions, and it makes the protagonist sound really weak and kind of simpering, like, oh, what's going on here? What are you about? What's happening in this?
Please tell me about the history of your people.
Yeah. And so I really like those voices, and I also like the female protagonist in Fallout 4. I think at least two of these people are the same actor.
It wouldn't surprise me.
And Emily in Dishonored, and I feel like there's one other, but I can't think of it at the top of my head. And they're all quite, they're not samey, but they, I feel like it's not surprising that I like them all. Like, they all feel like of a piece, kind of. They all, because protagonist voices in the first place are quite a narrow, there's a narrow range in which you can, that you can get away with. Like, if you make a character that's too their personality is too distinctive in some way, it's going to piss off a big percentage of your players. Like, you know, if you have a really grouchy character, a bunch of people don't like that. And if you have like a character who makes loads of jokes, there's going to be a bunch of people who don't find their jokes funny and are annoyed by that. And so protagonists are always going to be a little bit kind of straight arrow or a little bit neutral. And you can inflect that with some personality and you can still make it a character. And but there are only a limited number of ways of doing that. And so I feel like these, a lot of those characters do it in a similar way. It's like someone who's not going to... I mean, Saints Row doesn't really fit into this because Saints Row character is definitely has a personality and does not worry too much about, you know, expressing too much of opinion and veering too much from the fiction because it's so silly that the players will accept that. But in most of those other cases, it's... if you're going to be semi-neutral, then it's good. The great thing about FemShep, I think, is that... she does with her inflection what they can't do with the rest of it, which is just sort of imply like a world weariness and just someone who's been through a lot of shit and just knows what they're talking about. And so even if you are asking a question of like, what's going on here, Jennifer Hale is one of the few people who can make that sound like a toughened military badass asking that question rather than a sort of a kid, you know, having to ask the adults what's going on.
And that's maybe an interesting angle on this question is the fact that, like, Shepard as a character represented a shift from, you know, well, from specifically for BioWare, from Dragon Age of characters, of the main character being the only one who didn't speak. You know, maybe associate, you know, it now feels like, well, of course you would expect the protagonist in an RPG to be voiced. But that came after the era of, you know, you picking a long, detailed conversation response that you would read. And then hearing the response back from a voiced character. And I think still that is one area where I do prefer the old way. Like, for me, like, you know, Shepard or the later Dragon Age games or any game where you pick conversation options, but you have a voice actor enough, particularly the ones where you're more like you're picking a keyword or picking a direction for the conversation. And then you hear the full line from the voice actor. Those games felt more like getting sort of co-directorship of a movie than getting to create a character. And I, you know, I'm not, like, kind of goes without saying how much I love Mass Effect. But, like, Shepard is a character you don't really fully kind of invent. Because obviously, like, the having it be voiced limits enormously how many options they can give you. Whereas the first Dragon Age game, which is the only Dragon Age game where the protagonist isn't voiced, gives you shitloads of options for every situation. You do feel like you can kind of chart a pretty granular course for yourself through it. Because, and you can, and that character's voice, a bit like Corvo in Dishonored 1, can be something that occurs in your imagination. You kind of imagine how you speak. And I think that's a different experience that is missed. However, that said, there are still plenty of games that do it. Like Pillars of Eternity does it. Most of those Obsidian in Exile RPGs were built that way because it's a particular school of storytelling that they're interested in. So doubling back to the question, the answer is still sometimes.
Yeah.
Fred writes via Scoo, I think, and then back via Fred again. Listen, we all know Die Hard and Home Alone are the best Christmas movies, but what's the best Christmas game?
I don't have an answer like a whole game that's all Christmas themed, but the Christmas mission in Hitman Blood Money always stands out as a great game and also a good mission in that game where it's a like rich Playboy's party. And it happens to be taking place in Christmas, so the guards are wearing, like, Santa hats. And you can, if you, the preference is a strong one, you can decide whether you're going to kill and disguise yourself as a guard with a Santa hat or a guard without a Santa hat. and it's the one with the glass-bottom jacuzzi where you can, like, I think right from the start, you can just see the bottom of the jacuzzi that the target is hanging out in and just shoot it out. It'll just fall to his death. And they're also doing, I haven't played it, but they're doing, like, a Christmas reskin of Paris for the new Hitman, where I don't know if it's like, I assume it's a new mission of some kind.
Must be a bit like the thing they did over the summer with the movie set in Sapienza podcast voice.
Yes. It is. The one thing I do know for sure is that it's free to all Hitman players. So I think that means whichever episode you own, you'll get the Christmas reskin of Paris, even if you don't own Paris, which is kind of interesting.
Spirit of the season, isn't it?
Yeah. I've been imagining that it's like an elusive target or something like that, where it's like, it's not going to be the same two targets that you have in the normal mission.
I think it'll be like, yeah, like the movie set thing in Sapienza, where it's not an elusive target in that you can do it multiple times, but it is a different set of people to kill.
That's actually the other thing that I'm going to play shortly. The rest of Hitman, because two whole episodes I haven't touched.
Yeah, Hitman is quite a good, fits into that quite nicely. There's lots of Christmas things in games, but you know, Hitman is somewhere between Home Alone and Die Hard. Let's face it, it's about killing people, but it's also about traps and yeah. I'd actually totally play the Hitman, but you are
Macaulay Culkin.
Macaulay Culkin. You're trying to hit a robber with a iron. That'd be great. But isn't a game that exists. So, never mind. Thomas writes, to wrap us up, What games have you played that best leveraged UI and or control schemes to make complex operations more intuitive and natural?
I think I talked last week about how Supreme Commander does this, where you can queue up commands, which is great, but also have a factory, for example, build one anti-air unit and then two artillery units and then a tank, and then repeat that build list and also send them all out to this location. And once they arrive at that location, start on a patrol path that goes through these five waypoints. And all of that stuff is pretty quick and intuitive to do. I can't remember what it was like to learn the first time. I'm sure it took me a while, but once you know how to use it, it's great. And then I haven't played it myself, but Graham will always rave about the web of influences in Democracy 3, I think it is, where it will sort of lay out all the policies and the parts of your government and society that they affect, and there will just be lines between every single one that affects any other one, and it will be a red line if it affects it negatively and a green line if it affects it positively. And it is enormously complex information that's presenting, but it kind of looks, it's very visually appealing, and also like, it's clear in the sense that any given piece of information you want, you can know where to look for it, and you can see that it's there.
I was actually thinking about this just now, and it occurred to me that like turn-based games, I've started to be sensitive to like when turn-based games don't get this exactly right. Like XCOM gets this exactly right. Civ, like Firaxis basically, have become really good at when you have like a big complex strategy game to manage or of a squad game or whatever to manage, the thing that I started to really appreciate is whenever you have a option to click a button that is like next thing to deal with, because often, you know, Civ or whatever can be played with a dozen different menus open and loads of different bars to keep track of and progress things, but you can also play it by hitting the end turn button, because as long as you keep hitting it, it'll keep telling you, but you didn't do this, didn't do this, and you'll eventually get around to everything. And I've become really aware of games that don't have that, other like games that I otherwise like. So Stellaris doesn't really have like, because it's a real time, because it, well no, not a real time game, because it isn't turn based. It is like the Paradox Grand Strategy games. It's on a clock. There is no, there's a good notifications bar that tells you the kinds of things that are happening, but there's still a sort of basic level of stress that comes with like, have I checked in on everything important lately? And the game that I've started playing pretty recently, because friends are playing it, is the Cyanide Studios version of Blood Bowl, the Games Workshop literally fantasy football game, Blood Bowl 2 specifically on Steam. And that is a straight up adaptation of a miniatures game that I'm a little bit familiar with, but it's never been like a huge part of my experience of miniatures games. But one thing that struck me as kind of interesting is like, it's really easy because it doesn't have a, like, one thing I kind of want is for it to give you the ability to click through all of your players until you've done all of the things you can do with all of them. As it is, it like gives, puts a white ring around the player if they're still capable of doing things, and puts a red ring around them if you've spent them, basically, which is like fine. But it took me a while to get used to the idea that I was going to have to do some diligence when it came to not forgetting to use some people. Which is actually a problem with miniatures games as well, is sort of not for, like, having to maintain the mental discipline to remember to expend all of your movement points or whatever it is on every character available to you, and to remember who has moved and who hasn't. And the game makes that a little bit easier, but it's something that games are specifically good through UI of just handling for you. Like, if you're playing a board game, there's some degree of memory that's necessary to kind of hold that information. And I think games should always get that right, because it really stands out to me when they don't. Yeah. And that, in any case, is all of the questions we have time for.
Mm-hmm.
And that was ended up as quite a long podcast again.
It's almost as if reducing the number of people on a podcast doesn't actually decrease its length.
It actually increases its length. I don't know how that's... I'm not sure how that happens. If you know how that happens, you can email us if you have any questions at questions@creatingcrowbar.com. Although I'm aware that we have more questions at this point than you do. You can also discuss this episode in our Discord channel, which is on Discord, which is a complicated link that someone emailed us to ably point out that we could just set up like a redirect on the website. So if you go to creatingcrowbar.com/Discord, it takes you to the Discord channel. I haven't done that.
So don't go there.
I might do that. It's a really good idea. And maybe in some future episode, you'll hear me say that. But for the time being, I'm going to say the thing I always say, which is that you should click a link in the show notes for this episode, which are on creatingcrowbar.com, or on the sidebar of the website, to get an invite to our Discord channel, which is lovely and full of good people talking about games and stuff. If you would like to follow us on Twitter, we are at Creating Crowbar. Or you can follow us individually. I'm at C Thurston, which is C-T-H-U-R-S-T-E-N. And Tom is
at Pentadact, which is P-E-N-T-A-D-A-C-T.
Thanks for listening, everybody.